you.
Good, good.
To do anything.
Oh, you like it?
So we have to wait until you're in 0.08 before you can even sign a release of information for us to be able to.
I went to the trouble of making sure I had copies on my computer here to go with everything for nothing.
A synthetic drug, then there's lots of things that could happen that would be unsafe to manage in the community. So it's become a really difficult thing, and confidentiality, of course. So you still have all of those things in play. But informed consent. If you don't have a legally stable person to
start
substance,
you're going to hang out at the public library.
So what if we had,
do we have
a
setting that they could go to that wasn't jail? But it was secure.
It's a life changer.
Yes. The,
what am I going to do with myself?
And we have
30-minute
response.
But will they keep them in the floor? Where will they do it?
Keep them to do the evaluation and make a determination.
Supposedly they need a...
Maybe they have a...
Lots of people, but they're not in need of a locked facility. Jail and the hospital are two locked facilities. So you'd go with the least restrictive setting. And so, depending on what the person is, they're not an imminent risk. Either of those are appropriate.
So where could they go?
Outpatient. Or well, to the residence center.
Okay, from the police officers. He said, well, they're going to let the person go. They're going to, you know, so let's, he gave me an example of one that was, this is mild, you know, some guy's out in the street throwing rocks at a car.
I think.
And it turns out, you know, the officers are kind of, they're a cop and call, so they're experienced and pretty decent at it, I think. I can tell from talking to them.
Because they created
some training that
and he says, so you take them in, they evaluate him, they say he's not a danger immediately to himself or anybody else, so they let him out, and, you know, 3 hours later, he's back on the street again. So they're going to now take him to jail.
Or take him to the EDA, have them assess him again, determine if anything's changed. Or the repetitive nature of what they're doing may be enough to say, let's not do the hospital, but let's try the rest of the center.
Yeah, so but we're leaving it to the, I mean, I was trying to do
it. Leaving it to the crisis. Actually, leaving it, once the police take somebody there, the assessment is in the emergency department doc's hands, plus the psychiatrist on call, plus our crisis worker. And our crisis worker can choose the hospital, or they can choose the rest of the center, which is our standalone like psychiatric unit. It's not locked. So the person will still be voluntary. Then a physician is there, nurses are there, and we have around the clock 24-hour staff away.
So is there anything that we could do to reduce the likelihood that they end up in jail?
I guess that's what I'm asking. They lost everything.
Maybe not. Maybe legally there's nothing to do.
I still think...
What is that?
It's a mobile crisis.
I can usually get those things.
It was definitely the
mobile. Mobile crisis is different than just your singular crisis person on call. I mean, that you could go and you would actually have perhaps a vehicle that you can safely assess somebody in the field. You could do a field sobriety test pretty easy. You could have the support of the police department and do the referral and link right there. Or if needed, you still need help to transport because the crisis workers can't transfer someone to a locked facility.
So that a mobile crisis unit would be something that you would recommend as a way that...
It is. I don't think our volume is big enough to support the cost. So it would take like a layered local funding to make it possible. But there are communities that have it. A respite detox center would be really nice. So that's one of the strategies that our agency is using is look at a detox center.
Well, it would be great. I mean, I think what would be a good idea for us to do is to come up with ideas like this to propose.
Because it's spread.
And one has to say, if what's already present,
we need either more of it, we need something, there's a gap. There's
I mean, that's what we have to somehow argue for.
I think
sometimes Julie and I were talking about this not that long ago, but there's also a gap in jobs.
They're like, you know, like
work programs for people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so, if you can get somebody into treatment and what they want to do is work, you should be able to help find something, some meaningful work to do. So there was that plus housing, basic needs being met, could take all the pressure off the emergency and first responders, because then you could have maybe more centralized intake, if you will. So they come from there. And they've been checking and go to detox. They come and they have a mental illness issue. They can be in a residential program or perhaps automatically see a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And the mobile.
Well, this is the kind of thing I think we should be proposing.
Yeah. Well, Matt, that's what we're talking. I think in here, this crisis response with law enforcement. That's really got to be accomplished at the scene. That's Mark and I, when we were talking about this, I said, you can create more of what you already have, or you can enrich your continuum, because you're not going to meet the needs of everybody.
I think we should try to enrich the continuum.
And this, the whole business about helping an officer at the scene helps the community, because the officer's taken out of it.
So in order to push for that, we have to be pretty concrete. This is what we require, and this is what we should. That's why I was saying that three little things we need to be intentional, and we need to talk about what resources we need in order to accomplish that intention. And we have to somehow coordinate.
Yeah, that's where it's going to be hard.
Yeah, it's all hard.
Anything worth doing, right?
I mean, so how to move it from idea to action? It's very concrete.
Okay.
Humane Society.
It's up to me to start. It is.
Can I take one more thing?
We do have a quorum. It's 6:08.
We did a mercy adoption from the Humane Society.
Okay. 6:08. I'm calling this meeting to order. Let's get a roll call.
Richards?
Yeah.
Bennett? Branham?
Yes.
Driscoll? Ferguson?
Yes.
Kilgore?
Here.
Rappaport?
Here.
Rollins Gay?
She was here. Stepped out.
Bennett's here too.
I think Bennett is here.
Yeah, he just went down the hall.
Sullivan?
Bill's still running his bike.
No, he's out of town.
Oh, he is.
Okay, so we have 7 members. Tonight we have minutes entered the meeting. And we have, 4 reports to look at, unless Scott, you brought one.
No.
So right now we have 4 reports to look at that we can try to get going with. Can I get a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Moved by Benita. Seconded by James. Any discussion on that? Okay. All in favor of approving the agenda, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. These are down here.
Okay, she needs one.
Yeah.
And they have printouts of all the reports here. If somebody needs a physical copy on that. Okay. We have an agenda. Do we have any public participation? I don't see any forms,
okay.
But Patsy.
Oh, it's okay.
We have Patsy Petrie.
Just 2 things again. As a county board member, I continue to thank you all for the time and effort you put in on this task force. The main thing that I wanted to mention to you all, in case you haven't kept up with the newspaper and the vote at last Thursday's county board meeting, the resolution was passed to hire the firm located in Berkeley to do the needs assessment. I don't know the time framework in relationship to when the negotiations will begin with that firm as to what they will cover and things like that. Maybe Michael has gotten that information or can't, but the reason for mentioning it to you that it seems to just run parallel and interlock potentially with everything you all are doing on the task force, and so if there is some interlocking that you all can share with the negotiating team that was appointed via the resolution as to what would be helpful for that consulting firm to do in relationship to what you all are going to be focusing on as a task force. It might really make the whole situation more robust. That's all.
Is there any other public participation? No? Okay. Closing public participation. Yes, we have the minutes from September 10th. Does anybody have any changes in that? If not, somebody make a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Motion by Rappaport. Is there a second on that by Bennett?
Second.
Is there a discussion, any changes in the minutes that need to be made? All in favor of passing the minutes as written, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes pass. Next up, we have our discussion of ideas for the reports and our next step. And we have, am I right on the number, 4 reports that committee members have sent in? All have pretty good ideas. And Sheila, you're the one Mark sent in. Was you and was Benita also involved in that?
Actually, Mark and I discussed it, and then a separate conversation I had with Benita, and we just went over the report.
Okay, so. Okay. And Driscoll's joined us. We have our conference table and we have our figurative whiteboard. So, as requested, I think probably one of the best ways to start, though, would be if everybody who submitted a report could briefly go over it, and if anybody has any questions on that or suggestions, they can throw that out then. First up in the packet is that Jay Kilmer's. And do you want to go over your ideas for us?
Yeah, I mean, I focused on areas that I didn't think necessarily other people would cover, so I didn't really mention like mental health and pretrial services, but I think those are important. So I tried to, I began just by hitting urgent issues, the things that we kind of need to deal with in the short run, and make some recommendations, particularly basically what to do with the situation of the downtown, of the downtown jail in terms of the construction issues and the issue of people who are there who shouldn't be there. And then the second thing I tried to do was put together some recommendations based on dialogue that we had with community members related to the issue of race in the criminal justice system. And then the third thing, I made a specific recommendation around reentry, trying to get someone to look full-time into monitoring the people who are on parole in the county. And then I made some points about dealing with the issue of the funding, particularly the public safety sales tax, and that if we are to recommend funding of programs or alternatives, that is probably the most likely source that we would have in terms of trying to get address how that money might be restructured in terms of its spending. I did, and then my final point was looking at, I mentioned the preventative areas, but I left those to other people to talk about, but also that I think, and this was kind of in response to Lynn's proposal about the idea of a permanent body to oversee this, and I just said that such a body is a good idea, but I think it would be premature at this stage to be hammering out the details of that we need to first look at addressing some of the urgent needs that face us and studying those in some detail, and then perhaps looking at how this might be fleshed out in the long term.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for James on this?
Will we get our ideas on the table and then kind of start talking about them? Because, I mean, I have comments on them, but I'm wondering if we should... What would you prefer? Do you want us to each kind of explain?
It doesn't really matter to me. It seemed to me like the easiest would be if everybody did an intro on their report and then we went from there. But if people think easier to as ideas, or there's certainly nothing stopping it from as these ideas are thrown out
if we start going from there.
I like your idea of getting the ideas out and then discussing personally.
And I assume we have a pin for the giant post-it note, right? I'll continue to preside over the meeting, but if people have something they want to start writing, I think that's in order. James has brought up a couple things on here. We've got, first off, he's suggesting dorms, I assume, in lieu of a new jail or a new wing.
Yeah.
I
suppose the broader issue is dealing with the downtown jail.
Yeah.
You're talking about physical plant thing.
But the specific problem, the crisis of the downtown jail, which is ultimately what kind of got us here anyway. So we. So the dorms is one solution, but not certainly not the only.
Well, it's an. Do we need to do this way, or can we just talk?
I'm just getting his idea.
Continue. I'll recognize everybody and try to keep the discussion going. But raise your hand, and I'll recognize people. And you have to at least pretend you're talking to the chair. So Julian.
So, what I was going to say is, I think that's a good concrete example that there are. To start thinking concretely about, and I think you suggest this in terms of identifying, and we have some information now on who's there on any particular day, but I believe we have enough information to say there are a fair number of people in the jail who are not there for violent offenses, who probably could be safely kept someplace other than the heavy duty security that the jail itself requires. I'm sort of partly asserting it and partly asking if everybody else understands it that way, because what you're suggesting seems to me like one concrete example, and I think there may be others. We were just talking about something Sheila has some thoughts about with respect to mental health, the type of facility that might be useful there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are all I'm suggesting now is there are multiple things that could be done that would not probably in total be as cost prohibitive as the kind of money that I'm hearing people talk about with respect to just let's rebuild a jail. So, anyway, I don't know if that's adding to what you're saying or not.
I think there's two. I mean, there's two parts to that. One is, the actual physical structure problem. I mean, the fact that, in my opinion, and I think most of us would agree, I mean, that's a hellhole. I mean, I don't really like the idea that people are being held there. But secondly, the question of, is there a way to, I mean, how many people don't even belong in a jail or certainly not in a high security facility? And the mental health cohort, would be one subset of that. I think people in traffic tickets might be another subset. There could be several subsets of people who are there who really could either be on the streets or, in a much, much less high-level security.
So for your first suggestion, add your profile inmates in jail, and that includes mental health, et cetera, but including risk assessment, right?
Yeah,
Okay, including risk assessment. So that's one and two. Just what other ones of Jim's do you want here? How would you term your one on race?
Well, I don't think that. There's three things there. So, I mean, I think we would just say, investigation of the racial discrepancies.
Study
question
on racial disparity.
Yeah.
And then with specific dimensions.
So let's, if I may, but I think we want to. I think we're going to want to pursue the issue of race by looking at it in more complex ways than simply the overrepresentation in terms of the total population. So the sort of question I have is, well, how many people who are, how many African-American men are there with significant mental health problems? Now, that's a little more specific than the whole population. That would tell us something, because we could then start looking at this terrific list of services that Mark described, and look at, we could begin to get a handle on, well, is the African-American population being served in some way that can alleviate this problem? And part of that is that some services might be, need to be to accommodate the population. At least, generally speaking, oftentimes, African-American men who get identified with mental health problems are not always willing to accept a mental health service. That might be true more generally as well, but I think it's a specific problem there. And it may be possible to design services that would be more, have better reach, be more acceptable if we understood what the need was. So we have to sort of define who we're trying to help. But anyway, what I'm saying, I think my more general point, I was mostly saying all that to just make clear what I'm after here, is I think we don't want to just say we want to study racial disparity. We want to just study how racial disparity impacts with the various other demographic and service needs of the community, so that we get it much more specific than the general statement, because the general statement doesn't get us anywhere. So anyway, that's my comment about race.
I mean, I agree with that. I mean, I think when we come to the issue of who's in there for traffic tickets, we also, I mean, we have the global picture of these racial discrepancies, but we need to, but we need to then say how is that reflected within, you know, within the specific issues and problems of the public.
So what I'd like to add to number three is crossed by various, we don't have to specify them all now, identifying factors.
I just want to say,
I just want to make sure. So this isn't up here, broken down by race. You're talking about for the study on racial disparity. You want it to.
I want it to be.
Look at subcategories of service, including
various categories,
including service categories.
Categories of.
Including
problems and services.
Service categories, and what was the other thing you said?
I don't know. Whatever I said.
Whatever you said. I thought you said including problems.
Well, the idea is that the category, the simple designation of racial disparity, so that we know we have X number of African American men, doesn't tell us enough.
Right.
We now want to know, okay, what are the details of, you know, what are they there for? What are their needs? What kinds of services would be useful? Because they may not be the same services that are currently in the community, even though we have a lot of services. That probably some of them are useful, but maybe not. Maybe there are gaps in those services. So we can begin to understand it a little better. I don't know if you. I'm not sure. I was mostly bouncing off of your impressive list of services, wondering, well, how do they match the actual needs, the actual needs that appear in the context that we're interested in the criminal justice system, people who are already in it or are at risk to be in it, or because you're really talking about more general needs of mental health services for the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess, part of the observation that's made in the report, and I want to be clear about this. What I submitted was a collaborative piece, even though it came in, it didn't even come in with my name on it, but the email came from me. But it was a work that, through email, Sheila had input on and contributed to, and then she solicited the input from Benita. So it's actually a reflection of the three of us, our thoughts on the issue. It is not solely attributable to me. I've kind of have viewed the question of race, and it's one of the reasons I've refrained from addressing the topic, is that from my perspective, when you talk about an evidence-based practice, evidence-informed model that is has proven effectiveness within the jail, within a jail setting or an incarcerated population, that inherent in that is the fact that it then is going to has effectiveness in working with people of color because they are overrepresented within the system. So if you institute an evidence-based model that's appropriate for use in a jail, and that it has can also be extended out into the community to follow them back into the community, that it would address the question of race. Sheila or Benita, I don't know if you might
add
to that.
I was going to say the same thing. That was so he spoke my words.
Great.
So yes, that's what exactly I was trying to say. So
should I put that down, or do you want me to finish putting his ideas up here? But,
that's exactly what
I was saying. Let's hold off a second. On getting to Mark's, I think we still have at least one more thing on James's. We definitely something else that jumps out here is the recommendation to spend more than 5% of the public safety sales tax money on programming. Currently, as I think everybody in here has had it beaten into their head, it's 5% on programming, 95% on basically facilities. Everything really comes back to facilities, either utilities for the courthouse or paying for bonds, and then 5% is on programming a program. We keep changing the wording, but I believe the best way to describe it is reducing juvenile recidivism.
Yes. You guys mm-hmm. And actually, I had a question about that in terms of exactly what you meant when you talk about reallocating the public safety, the 5%, because that money is currently used for programs targeted to juveniles, but is actually applied to a restorative justice model mm-hmm. and fits in with what's recommended by in Lynn's report.
Well, James,
when you talk about reallocating that particular 5%, you're moving money.
Yeah.
Serving.
And I'm
going to
guess,
juvenile.
James, you didn't mean moving that 5%, but other money. Being, we've shifted. This money shifts around
change
every year, anyways.
Like
wants to reverse the percentage.
Fairly, some of it is going. The last couple years, and this was new, it's been used to pay to help take some stress off other county budgets and pay, for instance, utilities of the courthouse or various building funds. Obviously, it's paying the bonds on these building projects. So, yeah, as long as it's related to the justice system, it could absolutely, there's no reason it only has to be 5%. What it was when we got this passed, part of the deal on all that was at least 5% would be used. And right now, 5% is used on this programming for this particular program, which everybody seems to think is doing a good job, but... James is saying spend more on programming to reduce recidivism and less on, say, BRICS.
Okay, so Julian. So it would be for alternatives to incarceration, programs, rehabilitative programming, et cetera, kind of? So is that what you're envisioning, James? Just anything other, just not facilities, not jail?
Right.
Okay, so for alternatives or mental health programming?
So this is part of this part I absolutely understand the least well. So, Mike, this is a question that mm-hmm. you probably know the answer to. Some of the suggestions, for example, just the one that James started out with, talking about an alternative placement or other place or alternative placements for people with mental health issues, might actually require spending some money on physical facilities. Mm-hmm. So presumably that would be entirely consistent then with this 95%. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah, if it's a county program, county facility,
yeah.
This public safety sales tax money would completely be germane for, say, building a mental health center, through the mental health board. The county oversees a lot of these social services already. In fact, Sheila and I had talked for a lot of the year before it got the kibosh put on it about trying to get a ballot referendum to increase funding for the mental health board to kind of cover some of the state cuts. So, yeah, there's a pretty wide net on programming, and like we said, there's been changes with the sales tax even as we've been going along, because say 5 years ago there was not public safety sales tax money being spent on say the electric bill in the courthouse. Mm-hmm. So there's breathing room in the budget, and on a yearly budget basis there are some things that can be built in, and then in a couple years this is. Right now, I think it's ranging 4.2 to 4.5 million, something like that. But north of 4 mil, and a significant chunk of that is going to be coming free in, I believe, fiscal year 2014, because we're going to have the bonds paid off on, I don't remember if it's the satellite jail or some of the last bonds on the juvenile detention center. But so, yeah, that money. What they're talking about when they're talking about building a jail is that we'll have the money, we can build a new wing, but it doesn't have to be spent on it. It doesn't have to be spent on facilities. This money, as passed by the county board and by the taxpayer, is for public safety. One of the things that's come up the last few weeks is, would say, money for the nursing home fall under that, because it's public safety for senior citizens. There's a lot of ways this can be interpreted, so it's absolutely within the mandate of this to spend more than 5% on social services. That's that. But that was just the agreement, and that's what's been going on.
I think there's one point in terms of this notion that these bonds are going to be paid off in 2014. I mean, I think we might need to investigate that a little more closely, because from my reading of what's been happening, I mean, that was the original projection, but mm-hmm. I mean, I think some of these have been refinanced, so the projection for paying them off is actually quite a bit later than 2014.
And it's certainly not going to be for 2020 a year free. It's not going to be all bonds. It's going to be one fairly major project that's going to be coming available. We're still paying for the courthouse. I think we're still paying for the satellite jail. But some money will be coming available.
So, if I may, just if I understand this, and I probably don't, but it sounds to me like even just saying within the current allocation of 95% to facilities, the interpretation of facility might not be rigid, as in if we developed some new programs that needed physical spaces in order to exist, we could, it seems to me, without necessarily saying, oh, we're increasing our social services budget, which
very
I
mean, true.
Simply call on it as facilities that we need. Yes?
Absolutely. Just like, for instance, the jail, we provide a facility that's county programming. If it's county programming, that would absolutely count for facilities if we were to build a building. A lot of these programs, we try to find them space here or rent somewhere, space somewhere else. But, yeah, it's absolutely conceivable that something like that could come out of this money if it were more major. As I was saying, every year if there's the will on the county board, some of that money can be moved around because it has. The money's getting shifted around to pay for various things at the courthouse, for utility bills. So some of that money can be shifted around. That money can come from other areas of the county's budget, theoretically. Kind of broke, but theoretically it could. And so, yeah, these are things that there could be some increased funding out of the public safety sales tax, and certainly reducing recidivism, doing anything that can be construed as decreasing the crime rate, and doing things to make people more productive citizens and decreasing the future crime rate, I think would be a germane use of this public safety sales tax money.
So the sales tax, when the bonds are paid off, the sales tax will not be reduced by a quarter cent?
No.
Will not be.
No.
So that's a permanent increase?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's permanent unless the planning board gets rid of. There is originally written, there was talk about sunsetting, but by the time the county board put an ordinance on it, that was
well, they passed the ordinance with the sunset, and then the county board passed another.
It was to overrule the popular
Okay.
Yeah, it was re. There was a new ordinance. The county board could vote next month to sunset that if it wanted, but it's not likely.
But I mean, I think for us, the idea is that this is a public, this is money that's supposed to be for public safety, and however we can kind of construe that how we want to construe it. It's not really our job to massage the county budgets and worry whether they're allocating it for the light bill and so forth. But in fact, to say if this money is supposed to be dedicated to public safety, then we recommend that those percentages be changed. Yeah. And that's not our fight to.
Yeah, and it's a very solid point and very well grounded to have on here. Spend more money, more public safety sales tax money, on programming and less on buildings. Anything else, James?
I think the other thing which is connected to this is the whole notion of having some kind of public participation in this, even in the discussion of public safety. And I mean, I'm hoping that the consultant who seems to be interested in having some of these public hearings, I mean, let people come forward and make some suggestions about what they about what they think about what public safety is and how the money could be spent. I mean, I think this also gets people to buy into what's actually taking place. I mean, like in New Orleans after Katrina, when the jail was wiped out, they wanted to rebuild the jail up to its old level, and people that were campaigning for alternatives asked people to put a full page ad in the newspaper and asked people to send in so a small donation with suggestions of what other ways the money could be spent, and they got hundreds and hundreds of suggestions. But I mean, I think it was a way of getting a little bit more popular support for what was taking place.
Is that going to happen with the consultant, with I?
Yes.
Is that they're going to have
ILPP, the plan is, the proposal from ILPP was to have, from all of them, because we put it in the RFP, to have public input, to have public forums. So
we can say in our report, in any event, that's important. Yeah. That's an important piece of it. Is that so? So how do you want me to phrase that? It's just opportunity for public input, including
on public safety issues.
Okay.
On that point, can I ask Patsy, what you have? Is it all right for us to have this conversation?
Ask the chair.
I'll ask you. Patsy suggested from public participation that we coordinate with this consulting group. I was a little bit I'm a little unclear about the mechanism for doing that. I mean, I know we'll talk to them, but I mean, what is there something we need to do formally?
It hasn't really been set in stone. You were more involved in the process, Patsy, than I was. But I don't really think ILPP has anything set in stone to say they're going to have 3 meetings with the task force or anything like that.
So what my thought is here is that in most things, a lot happens in what's sometimes referred to as before the beginning. So I'm thinking maybe we could be proactive with them prior to having everything all set and them coming in with their plan and sort of knowing what they're going to do. Can we, in a proactive way, tell them we would like to have, I'm not sure what we'd want to have, but some clear mechanism for the mutual influence process between the consultants and the task force in a proactive way?
Recommendations for consultant?
What I was referring to is in the resolution, there's a negotiating team set up. It's the chair and vice chair of facility or their designee, state's attorney, sheriff, and county administrator. The chair of facilities designee is Carol Ammons. The vice chair, who is John Jay, has appointed a designee, or at least maybe something's happened. I'm not aware of that. They're the ones who are negotiating as to what will be done by this firm. I like your term about before things start. And that was what I was sort of referring to in my public comments, that it's a very opportune time for this task force to maybe share some of what you would like to see done.
So can I put that down? Just so identify priorities for consultant?
I guess I'm just a little clueless about how to do what was being suggested.
I think the RFP, the request for a proposal from the county, and the proposal from IOPP were both fairly detailed. However, there was not a lot of detail on what the formal role of this task force would be. So to a large extent, I think we are going to be creating our role there. And I think that IOPP is going to be very open to that. They're going to want to work with us, build on what we've already done. But we're going to have to basically informally negotiate with them what our role is going to be on that. And like I said, I think they're going to be very open to that, but it is not set in stone. Say they will have three meetings with the task force. They will do, say, a 7% weighting on their rankings on something with the task force recommendations. No, it's basically just asking that they work with the task force, and that's not really defined. I'm thinking that if we get a report, or at least the bones of it done fast enough, that's probably somewhere they're going to want to start, at least for the non-facilities part of their report. But we'll see. I think that we probably will end up with a good enough report that we'll have done a lot of their work for them and that they would be crazy not to. But none of that's set in stone. We're going to have to work with them on that.
So will you be communicating? What's your role in that?
On behalf of the task force, yes. Carol Ammons is the county board member who's going to be working with them. It should be fairly anticlimactic to get this locked down. They had they've been voted on. They had a contract. They submitted a bid, and including monetarily. So I'm not sure how much there really is to hash over with them on that. But so Carol Ammons is going to be there setting that up with him. And I don't know that the negotiating team is going to want to make it what the task force is doing more formal anyway. But at the same time, I think IOPP is going to be very open to working with us and probably integrating this task force into some of its public comment, public forums, and those kind of things.
But one of the options would be potentially, because you said you thought we could do something fairly quickly. That would one of the options be to develop, and we'd have to couch them, whether we couch, and you don't want to say tentative, but preliminary, you know, recommendations, something like that. Part of which would be to identify where we believe the consultant could be most helpful. My own personal view is really can benefit, when I say we, the county, benefit from the number crunching, because I think we are going to do a lot of what the consultant will otherwise do, and we save the consultant a boatload of time. But we need the numbers to get the county board on board and say, if you do this, it will cost money, this money, but it will save you X, and have them do it based on risk, and it will save this number of beds in the jail. To do that number crunching that establishes the compelling case for the recommendations we made, which are most of those I've seen are based on data. And then, after working with the consultant and getting public input and everything, then issuing a final report. But I'm just, again, I hate, one thing I guess, I feel like there's almost, again, there's two processes going on, ours and then the jail, and I'm afraid that if we don't move with dispatch, for one, the consultant won't be able to assist the county in the way I believe the consultant can, and somebody's got to do that number crunching. So anyway, so I would, if you don't mind, I'd like to liberty of it, and we can add others later, but I'd like to say data crunching is what, or let's just, could we put an asterisk there, because I think we should later identify what priority tasks are, and I don't want to forget that. So we can just, if something there. Because I know for me personally, I'd really like to see some of that data crunching so we can see specifically how the impacts, like, of the recommendations you have made, what impact might that be on the job population? That will really affect what they decide to do as far as the physical plan.
Well, just to say, I think we have plenty of ideas. What we don't have is staff. We don't have people that we can say, well, go do this. So, I mean, presumably, that would be a reasonable...
Exactly. They're the ones who are getting paid, and so theoretically have the man hours to do some of the legwork on this, that maybe follow up on some of the ideas that the task force has already rounded up. In addition to several of you being academics and everybody working with the system, everybody here is local, which this company is not. So that's what we can bring, local expertise, particular expertise, Illinois expertise. They're based in California, and they do national stuff, but I really doubt that they're going to be able to keep straight in their head the differences in Illinois code versus other places they're working. And so these are things we can help them on, and I think their proposal was they thought that this would take a certain number of hours, obviously, and presumably that's going to include doing the number crunching and the legwork on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's great.
I have James? Two other things on this. I mean, one is just, I mean, I did put a proposal here for reentry support, and I think just to follow up, just to make sure we get the thing on the race clarified. I mean, while I agree that we want to see how it works, in various subsectors and so forth, I mean, there's a whole set of things before people end up in jail that need to be examined as well in terms of, the various steps. So on the one hand, we may have, like, evidence-based programs that are dealing with people once they're in jail, but I think we're also talking about, what's happening in terms of profiling and traffic stops all the way from there to the sentencing kind of piece. And I think there's a whole set of investigations there that has to be part of any kind of picture of that. At the same time, looking at it within the subsets of mental health and traffic tickets and that sort of thing.
So this one, you had a full-time person to help with reentry from prison, right? And,
right.
And you also, I think there was a sub-recommendation. You'd like that. And I think we should put that up here. You think that some a former inmate would be most helpful, right?
I think ideal is somebody who has some...
All right. And then, the other thing was it the prior on the prevention?
I was just following up on the race thing before. I think it's all right the way it is for the moment.
Okay.
Julian, your report is next in our packets. And it's
let me try not to repeat myself too much. What I considered the final note, which is something that I thought about after I thought about it. These three little things that I added. So if you go to that last page there. I have some general notion that we have to think about things in terms of intentionality. And what I'm talking about here is that I think it's easy to speak about this in very general terms and to talk about alternative programming without being very specific about, exactly who do we have in mind? Who is the target? And this would interact quite well with what James was just saying. So if you're talking about, and maybe it's a little bit of what I was trying to elaborate before, if you're talking about race, you need to then talk about what do you intend to accomplish at which place in the system? Maybe I should precede this with saying, I think we have to think about this as a system. That's actually what I started with, is the idea that it's a mistake to think about this piecemeal. So what the police officer does and what the judge does and what the prosecuting attorney does and what programs are available in our community, these are not independent events. These all interact, and there's really a system. And so, therefore, it's easy to, it's one thing to talk about it that way, but it's another thing to talk about, well, what do we intend to accomplish at each place in that system? So what I'm suggesting is we need to specify quite specific goals about what we're trying to accomplish in terms of who we're trying to serve and what needs we're trying to serve, because I think that we need to then address what I'm calling capacity. That is, we have to then talk about, given that we have these very concrete goals, what resources does that require? And some of those resources you can talk about in terms of dollars, but some of them you can talk about also in terms of personnel, in terms of, if we start to get specific, as if we were writing a proposal for a specific program, they're going to require that we say, in order to accomplish this intention with this type of program, what would it take? So, you know, I'll just use it because it was the first thing offered, the idea of alternative place to house people who are nonviolent. Well, what does that require besides saying that? Well, there's going to be obviously some sort of facility need, but what sort of personnel need would there be? How much would that cost? It seems to me, in order to be practicable, we have to start specifying both what we intend to accomplish and what capacity we think it would require to accomplish it. And then the last thing I wanted to say overall is coordination, because this came through to me just reading that report from the mental health group here. There's a lot of programs out there, and I have no idea how to figure out, are these things coordinated? How do they happen? How many of them are pertinent to the population of people that we're thinking about? How many such people are served? This includes not just race, but also type of problem. So I think we need some device for coordination, and that's why I was saying I believe that, I know Mark has talked in the past about systems of care, and the Mental Health Board has a view of what a system of care is, and I was interpreting Lynn's notion about some sort of coordinating council. I don't know if I'm using your exact vocabulary, but I do think we need to actually think about how we could build in a structure that would consider all of these problems systemically rather than one at a time. And so that's kind of to me, that's a really big thing that it's important for us to speak to. Otherwise, you end up with all these ad hoc programs. Each one sounds good, but they're not well coordinated, and you never really know what's being accomplished. So we have to...
You could read my little... Is this a device for coordination of programming and... For a systemic approach.
That's adequate for me.
You didn't specify goals, but what you wrote also mentions specifying, I would call performance measures. You said modes of assessment, basically.
Right.
That's a separate
How are we going to know that we're doing what we said we were doing?
So specify, I'll put it here, but you could have...
You know, what's implied there is some sort of process of evaluating, which has to be really done, built into the process, so that in an ongoing way, you're monitoring what you're accomplishing to see if you're accomplishing so you can make adjustments. Mm-hmm. If you're not accomplishing, but you wouldn't know that unless you specified your goals first.
And how you're going to meet it.
So all those things they're pretty general at some level, but they become quite specific as ways to do ongoing evaluation. So
specify performance measures. Can I just add first parenthesis, because you had mentioned both current and new programs. So that would be, you know, someplace we don't look for accountability is actually like the jail, for example. How much do we see the staff on that? So you said current and new programs. And then what else did you want?
And then I think we need to have what I would call ongoing evaluation. That's a part of viewing it as a system, is that you have built in periodic assessments of whether or not, and it won't be whether or not, actually, it would be how well we're moving toward the goals that we specified. So, with the implication being that you adjust what you're doing. A lot of times when we develop programs, we think, oh, we got the program, that's it, so now it's settled, and that's what we do. A better way to think about it is, we start with this program that we think is our best shot at accomplishing the kind of goal we have, but we monitor it as it goes on, and we understand right out front that we're going to have to modify it based on what we see us accomplishing. To me, that's an extremely important part of this, because otherwise what you do is you build in the expect. People become very defensive about the programs that they're running, and they think that it's a criticism, and so people get resistant to change. Whereas if you build in right from the beginning the idea that all programs will be continuously evaluated with an aim toward maximizing the achievement of the goals that were specified, and change is expected so that you can modify in order to better meet the goals. Some having that philosophy seems to me really important.
Modifications in light of evaluation findings. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's good. Okay. I mean, I don't know if anybody wants to disagree with that or not, but it does require us to actually attend to it. So maybe a lot of what I said is really about that. When I was talking about the availability of community alternatives, I think my general philosophy there is that it's a mistake to think about everybody as the same, and that some programs that work really well for some people are terrible for others. And it turns out that the more programs you have, the more options you have, the more alternatives that exist, the more people you're likely to be able to serve well. I think one of the things you will discover, if you're monitoring it, is that, oh, this program really works well for this set of people, but it doesn't really work for this set, whereas a completely different program works for somebody else. The only way you can know that is to try it out and monitor it and see who for whom it's working. So it's not going to ever be... Realistically, it wouldn't be, it's less about does this program work and more about does this program do good things for who? And who for whom doesn't it do good things? So then we know what the gaps in the system are.
Can I ask a question? Is it just programs or also alternatives to incarceration? Is that when you, are you
saying? Yeah, that's, I'm using that term generically.
Okay,
right.
Right, got it.
And with respect to prevention programs and alternatives to incarceration, what I was trying to get at by using just an example that I'm quite familiar with is that it's really possible to divert people from the justice system if you do it intentionally. So the more intention we have to do that, the more likely we are to accomplish it. And you know, I mean, the obvious place to talk about prevention, because it's easiest to think about, is with young people, right? So if you're talking about juveniles who are starting to get, there's a lot of evidence that kids who are now what you might think of as in legal jeopardy, but not yet adjudicated, they do better if before they get into the justice system, you develop diversion alternatives, often in collaboration with police and judges and so on, but you don't actually enroll them in the justice system. It turns out, and we have evidence from the past done locally as well, although it wouldn't be just locally. Once you pick these kids up to the point where you now have even just, which happens a lot, is, you know, they'll get put on probation, it's too late, because then, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this. One is that there are, especially in a community of this size, although it's true more generally because things operate really in neighborhoods anyway, in bigger communities, everybody knows who they are, and they're the kids who are, they're involved with the justice system. And the kids think about themselves that way. And the same kids with identical characteristics who, instead of being referred to the justice system, get, they have to be existing alternatives, but get put into social service alternatives that are realistic and monitored and have those same kinds of evaluations that I was talking about, can often be just never arrive in the justice system at all. I know, I am sure, I can't tell you exactly what the percentage is, but some non-significant percentage of young kids can be removed from the justice system before they ever get to it. So, and that, it's amazingly powerful what happens when they become formally a part of the justice system, even with everybody's good intentions. Nobody wants to lock them up now. They just want to get them on probation so they can get some services. Probation's not the best first services for kids. The best services for kids are some alternative to probation. So I don't know where exactly that fits in or what to say about it in the single.
Can I pick up on something that I heard in what Julian was saying? Sometimes we can do something, but I heard something even bigger than diversion. It was almost, it's getting this systemic commitment to it. Because again, you can have diversion and it works for a year or two, but it has to be in the system. And I mentioned in a footnote this Brooklyn prosecutor who it's in his system. And these are people who are, you know, seriously, it's subject to mandatory minimums. They have to have two felonies and so on and so forth. But it sounded more than, it's diversion, but also, and then to get that commitment, I think that'd get us into training and the like. So we can say, but it's got to be almost like a cultural change.
I think that's correct. That's, I agree with that completely.
So I wonder if right now, I don't know if cultural change sounds too general right now, but one of the things we're talking about is changing the culture of this system. And that's part of what I'm hearing what you're saying. It's more than diversion.
Well, yeah, my only, I agree with what you're saying intellectually.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to think about is
how to
present it in a way that isn't quite so. I mean, when we talk about culture change, it raises all kinds of imagery.
We can put something up later. I was just hearing more than. Otherwise, you'll say, let's augment the diversion program that's already there, which is laudable. But I'm hearing of something.
No, what I think is necessary is, I think culture change is right if everybody understands what culture change means, but it's it often creates resistance.
Right.
So I'm thinking that our goal, and I don't even mind that we say culture change, but we then should be more specific about what we would do to implement the steps that would have to be taken. So. And I was using diversion as a kind of generic way to think about diversion, not so much in the narrow technical sense of, I mean, I know that's a term that exists in the criminal justice system now. Everybody knows what it means, and it has, although it's implemented in different ways in different places, but to think about more generally, we do want to divert young people who are at risk from the diversion, from the criminal justice system as the main source of caring for them. Now that requires us to have very specific, I call it programs, very specific ways of thinking, very specific steps that are taken, and it does require community. It requires the whole community to kind of be in on it. And to me, that's the whole beginning premise of everything I'm saying, is that we ought to try to at least make clear to the county board generally and to the public generally that we don't think the problems, I'm not even sure how to phrase this, but that we do not believe that the problem of people getting in trouble with the law is something that should be isolated into the criminal justice system as the answer. What we think is the criminal justice system should be a part of a community collaborative that involves many other elements of our community. So everybody has to be willing to engage it. You know, the schools have to be willing, the mental health system has to be willing. But to say it's up to the, for example, to say it's up to the sheriff is crazy. I mean, it can't. There's a tendency for communities to think that criminal justice, that issues of people and crime and public safety are somehow limited to people who have those very specific jobs, and I think it's a mistake. So, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I think, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, this is a philosophical change from a punitive kind of system, which is what we have now. So, I mean, the kind of goals that we would set and so forth would have a very different kind of orientation. But I mean, I think connected to that is having a broader public discussion about the issue of public safety. What does public safety mean? Because public safety to most people is associated with policing and institutions to confine people. And I think I think that's an entry point to have this philosophical discussion, not necessarily talking about cultural change, but to try to think of these issues in a different way. Because I think you're right that we can't. To deal with alternatives to incarceration, if they're really alternatives, it means that at each and every step of the system, people have to start thinking differently about what it is they're trying to do. And I mean, that's obviously not something that's going to happen in a week, but I think that's a debate and a discussion that we can spark and facilitate. And it's one that's going to take years to actually carry out, but it hasn't really. It's just getting going now.
So I'll try to get past this so other people can talk. But within this general way of thinking, what I then did was to try to look into the literature and I got some consultation from people in other places, and I read a few things, and there's a lot of literature out there, and it's not all. Sometimes this program works here, sometimes it works there, sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it does work. So there's no sort of single definitive answer to alternatives to jail. But I listed a bunch of things here, and things that everybody knows and that other people have already mentioned, community and restorative justice, community worker service, day reporting centers, drug courts, electronic monitoring, fine forfeiture programs, home detention, intensive supervision, substance abuse treatment and work release. Every one of these things, there's a literature on. And the conclusion from the literature really is that any one of them can work if they are implemented well, and have sufficient resources and apply to the appropriate population. So some of them work for some people and not others. When they don't work, it's almost always fair to say they don't work because you didn't do it right. I mean, so a lot of times people say they have a program and you go in and look at it and they're not actually doing the things that program requires. So that's why I think it's important for us to keep talking about intentionality and capacity and evaluation. But in general, I think we ought to be in favor of as many alternatives as this community can be encouraged to provide. That we ought to think more of as a broad spectrum rather than thinking that we have to come up with the two programs mm-hmm. that now will have some new things. We ought to really try to emphasize that in some ways the role of a county in this can be to encourage the development of as many alternatives that are where there's clear intentionality and capacity is made clear and it's evaluated as possible, because I'm pretty sure that the more alternatives we have, the more likely we are to be successful as a system. Not that any one of them will somehow solve the problem. And so to somehow get that idea off, we want to encourage the development of new things.
One of the questions I had, because I agree with you, I just wondered if we should still give a starting, in other words, if we say there's, because there's, I think I mentioned this at the last meeting, I think it's Arkansas, lists 28. If we just say, hey, 28, and it'd be, and we could even say that's where we want to head, but I'm just wondering, and we don't need to do it right now, if we still should identify several that we think are particularly noticeable gaps in this system.
Oh, yeah, I agree completely with that.
All right.
The one last thing I'll say here is when I was talking about pretrial services, and you've talked about other people know this literature and have ideas about various pretrial services. I think other people have mentioned, and it seems obvious to me, that we can do a better job on bail policy in terms of people who could be let out on their own recognizance and people who could, we could create a system that people can actually afford without risking public safety. But, you know, there's one where we need some number crunching to really take a look at it. And some, you know, I'll say sort of lack, I believe we would need, in terms of coordination and thinking about it as a system, it seems to me that we not only would have to have the state's attorney willing to think that it's possible, whatever the intentions, that we could even do a better job than we're doing now, but we would also need the judges, I think, we have to have the judges somehow involved in this, because they're the ones who make the decision, I think. And so if there's some mechanism for us to get into dialogue or into collaboration with the judges, I think that seems incredibly important to me, in both in terms of all these alternatives, actually, both pre-adjudication and post-adjudication. So the judge ultimately has to believe that the programs that are being offered are good and increase rather than decrease public safety. So they have to be somehow a part of this process. I think we're making a big mistake if we don't somehow get them involved in owning some of this, or maybe all of it. And the final comment, which really came to became obvious to me listening to the public input last time, has to do with I think we should try to figure out a way to benefit from the existence of a community of responsible African-American men who are willing and care about the men in their community who are either in or at risk for legal difficulties, and really not expect them to do it just as volunteers, but to figure out some way to develop, to finance programs that would hire African-American men who are pretty savvy and have street credibility, who could, for example, credibly get somebody from the jail who's in need of mental health services to actually accept a mental health service instead of just relying on a referral and the guy thinks that this mental health stuff is ridiculous, but having somebody who's working with existing mental health programs and can actually help the person move from jail to there, not just by telling them, but by being with them, then who has that kind of credibility rather than some distant mental health worker who they don't really believe. So I think the county could create a cadre of such workers. And I know that there are plenty of men out there who are capable of doing this, but some sort of structure needs to be set up to make it real.
And is it exclusively, what did you want me to put this down for? So you mentioned pretrial services, but it's also
military? I mean, I happened to think about it at the first time when I wrote it down. I was thinking about it in the context of somebody who's, going to be out on their own recognizance, it would be more likely that they might come back if there was actually somebody that was in touch with them.
All right.
Like that. But then I wasn't limiting it to that. I'm then thinking.
Community worker.
All right.
Yeah, community workers.
Kind of peer navigators, regardless. Maybe it's racial.
Could be to facilitate the goals of pre-child services program.
And it just ranged all the way through the system. You could have people like that responsible for. I like your term. Peer navigator was just offered as a.
Peer navigator?
That was the term just offered, but yeah.
To navigate the entire system, though, not just pre-trial.
Yeah.
Right. So I've got reentry down there and then et cetera.
It overlaps.
Et cetera.
Mm, with yours, yes, very much.
So, anyway, I said enough, I think.
Well, you had mental health on there, and you touched on it a little bit with the pre-trial services. Before I get to the mental health, let me say I think we need to push pre-trial services and the bail, both because the justice system currently already realizes that there's a problem with people getting bailed out, that that's falling through the cracks, and that honestly there are more people in jail that need to be there, even than the judges and public defender and state's attorney think should be in there. And correct me if anybody disagrees, but I thought it sounds like McLean County has a very good pretrial services system that is fairly easily implemented here and pays for itself. And that is one of the things that could, if the stakeholders buy into it here, could pretty quickly get implemented. And so we should push them to do so. On the mental health, I would say we should make sure that we just start at bare bones. Mental health services for the justice system here in Champaign County, when the sheriff's office came in and said, we have the resources to give people just enough mental health care so that they don't die, that's what they meant. We will do our best to make sure you don't die while you're in our system because of mental health problems, and that's really about all that we can do.
And they don't always succeed in that.
Yeah, that is correct. There have been several times where that has to. So I think we definitely can push increase mental health resources for
the front end to back end.
And there,
criminal justice system. Yeah. I realize it can be even before.
And I'm specifically thinking there about that's what I mentioned here, is that having the idea of an aggressive mental health case manager so that the kind of services they get would not just be, they're in the jail, you know they got a mental health issue, now they're assigned a mental health case manager, and that means this is a person who's going to advocate in exactly the way we were talking about before and for a different problem. This is a person who needs to be figure out how that person can make use, as they move out of the jail, of the existing community resources. And maybe we'll learn that some of those resources have to be adjusted or made more suitable. Maybe there are already plenty that are plenty suitable, but they're not being taken advantage of. But I think it often works in these cases, especially with mental health systems, where if there's a case manager assigned to this person, not just while they're in one setting, but the idea is that you're sticking with that person as they move out through and they're out in the community now, and then they're working in collaboration with mental health people, you have a way better chance of success, and you have a way better chance of them not falling through the cracks and not coming full circle. So somehow thinking about it that way.
And in the current system in Champaign County, and presumably statewide, not only do you not really have any resources, you don't have any resources for anything outpatient generally. If you're lucky, you won't fall through the cracks, and you might be able to get assigned to a nonprofit in the community, and it's on the nonprofit to do. The sheriff says, I think at any one time, he has 10 people who are all booked up and ready to go to a state facility, should not be in our facility, but there's no space, and so there. He says at any one time, there's usually 10 people waiting to go to a state facility. It's a real crisis. And of course, that's state funding, not too much we can do about that except to push for a reevaluation on that. But it's a big crisis, just a big basic crisis in our jail, no resources.
Though we might not mention this in a preliminary report, if we think we might do something preliminary, consultant, and final, I mentioned several months ago potentially having a section of our report that flags things that, that we want to do as a county in terms of lobbying the state and joining with other counties. So I think that I would like to just put something out there about recommendations to the state. I actually think they should, we might mention in our preliminary report that that will be in our final, but we should start thinking about that, and that that long term is what Champaign County needs to do, is to ally itself with other counties. Well, not necessarily, we may actually say, let's just give up on the state, and we have to have a self-sustaining system too, but in any event, I don't think...
Well, I think we could think about... we could think about providing the kind of mental health services that you think the sheriff was looking for at the county level. I think it's quite possible, and maybe better. There's a lot of evidence that it's better to do it locally than it is to send them away. And we have lots of people in this community with the capacity to help create that, if it's not already partly there. So you may, I'm sure you have something to say about that.
Actually, they need to use local hospitals more. They need to be able to move people from the jail to the local hospital, help them there, and then if they have to go back to jail, so be it, if they can go into mental health court. I just think that the system needs to be fixed to allow that to happen. When I've seen that happen, it works really well for someone, because I think I mentioned this before too, access to current medications is huge, because I know that the county doesn't buy medications that we're using even and are outpatient. So, for example, they're still relying on Prolixin and Haldol. We haven't used those for years. That's the only because it's less expensive, and the more expensive medications, you know, like Zyprexin and a few, they're very expensive, and the county has to purchase those. So really working with not a contractual mental health provider, so here's, you know, you can couch this in my own feelings about the mental health, the link between the folks in the jail who are providing mental health and community-based mental health. And now let's just take it one step further and stop saying mental health and say behavioral health. So mental health and substance abuse in both locations. To have that coordinated care, there has to be a business relationship or perhaps a letter of intent or something that allows the organization within the jail to easily make referrals to the organization outpatient. We are exceptional in our community. We're funded to help people who don't have benefits through the 708 board for criminal justice for adults. And so all you have to do is call us and say, we have somebody, you know, we want to refer them, and we can have them. We prioritize them into our psychiatric services. But again, peer navigators, other ways, motivational interviewing, best practice, evidence-based models will help improve those gaps. So I think what I'd want to say, Lynn, is just a general comment of, we have some mechanisms that we need to work on in terms of how to coordinate care, and that it needs to be intentional, and it needs to disrupt what we're currently doing. In other words, we all have to have that goal in mind, and that person touches the justice system, that we can see what it is, who it is that we need, and then divert them either through diversion programs or services.
So, Sheila, is that coordination between criminal justice officials and community service providers?
Closer coordination, working agreements or working relationships that encourage coordination and maybe even incentivize coordination.
And are you saying if there were closer coordination between the justice system in Champaign County and providers, that the capacity is actually out there to do more?
Well, I think we could see the benefit. I mean, drug court obviously is a good example. Over years, we see it closer and closer, and relationship and more people benefiting from it. Mental health court is going the same way. Mm-hmm. But now if we had, you know, a few, maybe a peer coordinator or navigator, and we had some, a system of care, so you could wrap services around. Because for anybody, and we know this, as we begin at Community Elements to implement substance abuse services, people don't know that we do substance abuse. Like, they don't. They don't know. Mm-hmm. And we probably have the longest-standing mental illness substance abuse group in town, which is a dual diagnosis group for people. And so it's about communication, everybody knowing what's available, mm-hmm. and probably peer coordinators or navigators that, you know, can tell somebody, you know, have you tried this? There's this. What fits best for you? What have you found to be helpful to work? providers don't have that kind of
and I think it would
time,
make sense.
So you have to build capacity in.
It makes sense for the for us to encourage the sheriff, or if we did this right and move the toward the kind of thing that you're talking about, the sheriff should be thinking about what the local alternative is. It should be, this is stuff that is way better if it's handled at the local level than if it's sent off. I'm not talking about funding. It's way better if the state were funding local level services. But to provide the services locally should be the way we should be thinking. Otherwise, well, we know from the history of mental health systems that there was a time when those state hospitals were gigantic, and there was no question about capacity. They just took whoever they got. And what they did was pull people out of their communities. They got worse. They became isolated. They, in some ways, it was a way to deal with the nuisance factor of seeing people with mental illness. But it was a terrible system, and it was like what we're worrying about when we talk about the downtown jail. Only that was supposed to be a mental hospital.
Well, and I do not sort of want to put a recommendation out there should be more beds at state-operated facility, because the same way that you don't want beds at the jail,
exactly.
Don't want them there either. And so what we do need is those alternatives. And I know Mark and I talked a lot about it, and then Benita and I talked about it this past week. And what we need, too, is the establishment of more respite detox beds, the kinds of alternatives.
Exactly.
To help interrupt for those first responders when they first get involved, whether it's the fire department, the police department, or even our crisis worker, to have in your back pocket is a place where someone can be taken safely to be kept overnight or possibly get some sleep, something to eat, and a roof over their head to be able to make a better assessment and build a relationship where you can see movement into services. And so Mark and I talked a lot about this because we see the need, and I think you and I talked about when we first came in, for more capacity in crisis, mobile crisis. But, you know, we are seeing some of the effects of not having a detox center. And so our agency is looking at how to do that, how to do a respite detox, because we already have 7 beds that are temporary beds for people with mental health conditions. And again, not very many people know about it, and they don't access it unless they get in touch with our crisis workers. So part of it would be, wouldn't it be cool is if we could have a unit that does both, and that, you know, we could, all first responders, instead of saying, oh, well, we're not going to be able to do anything but take them to jail tonight, or, you know, we don't know what, I think they're under the influence, so informed decision making is not an option right now, or, you know, we don't know if their family members are around, whether we can get in touch with them at this point. They're not telling us much about that, or, you know, those scenarios that usually land you somewhere where somebody has to take protective custody may be able to be deflected.
And I know from speaking to local police, some of whom I know well enough to have honest conversations with, that they would welcome this kind of thing. This is something that we could really enhance police community collaboration. Because they're the people who they're the first responders, right? That's especially poor people. That's who they call.
Well, and how does this work in communities that are doing this? Is anybody familiar with any of these functioning?
We do have next to us in Decatur, the mental health agency, behavioral health agency, Heritage, that has a 16-bed respite and detox. And actually, that's the motto that we're using to plan for an expansion. But you know, it's about resources and space and some things like that. But it's not stopping us from having the discussions. In fact, I talked to the sheriffs the chiefs of police about it, and they're very anxious to see about how we can get detox or some beds back. And so my recommendation, and of course you're going to find us, I'm repeating the recommendations in our section, so maybe I'll stop, because I was hesitant to say anything up until this point, but I just help myself.
No, I was thinking to
it. Who would fund this? Who funds it in Decatur?
Well, it's funded through a mechanism. The state funds some of it for people who have Medicaid or insurance to cover their costs, would fund some of it, and some of them have to be community-funded beds. And so it's a balance, much like we do with our psychiatry. We have funding from the state for it. We have the ability to bill for some of the services. And we have local support from the 708 board and also from donations and people from inside the community.
Well, and if we go back to our discussion about financing, you need to have a space for it, right? You have to have a place. Well, that could be funded from the county, theoretically, right?
Facility.
Can I ask a question, just because I want to make sure? When you guys say behavioral, you include substance abuse.
Yeah.
What else are you including? Because I'm wondering if we can just understand, I'll put behavioral, the first place we have mental health, and then can we safely say whenever we've said mental health? I mean, I've heard substance abuse, we have the same deficits in terms of program availability. I saw that in your group report. But, I mean, that doesn't mean we'll always say behavioral, because I think it bears mentioning mental health, substance abuse. But I just wanted to see what else is covered by that. Is the reference to cognitive...
That would not.
That's not.
No.
So you're really thinking mental health and substance abuse?
Yeah.
In terms of behavioral health.
Okay. Well, then maybe we can just always say mental health, substance abuse.
Well, we won't. I mean, we don't look at it that way. The industry looks at it as behavioral health. And actually, you know, in another year, it'll be integrated care, mental health, substance abuse, and primary care.
Okay.
So, but for the purposes of our community, we do have separate providers. We have funders who are just substance abuse alone, too. And so I think we wanted to make sure.
You know, if we really...
Because we weren't talking about community elements. We were talking about the community. There's a number of substance abuse providers and mental health providers. So,
and there are some things happening with, just as community elements is looking at or is involved in substance abuse, Prairie Center is moving from substance abuse to behavioral health.
Mm-hmm.
They're also looking at opportunities that they may have to work with Provena in terms of services within Provena Hospital.
It's also totally appropriate to think about this in terms of public health. There is a public health system, and there are public health funds and grants available that if we were thinking about this as a system, because physical health and mental health turn out to be very closely intertwined. The life expectancy of people with a serious mental health problem is significantly lower than, for lots of reasons, but it ends up, you get into issues of chronic health problems, heart problems, diabetes, all kinds of things that is appropriate in the public health domain. And there is, I think there's an unexplored relationship here between the public health system and the criminal justice and mental health system. So rather than thinking about them as separately, we ought to somehow talk also about including public health in this collaborative.
That's probably a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
And the physical health.
Yeah.
Because I believe that it's true, too, that the sheriff was talking in his original report about the cost and care for someone who has a serious physical health issue, the cost to the jail in terms of how to help
exactly
meet the needs of someone. And so maybe those are also, and that to me would be a resource, could make some differences with resources.
And there are some family service as a chronic disease self-management program that they do. It's for... So that it educates, in, like for a person with diabetes, to educate them about what they need to do to care for themselves, and, you know, in terms of diet and reinforcing those and working with them. So.
I unfortunately have to leave in a little bit. I have to go do my day job, which is taking minutes of the meeting. But anyway, so I want to just make a couple comments if I could. One is it seems that... I'm just trying to think about how big the mental health issue is here, and that it also is an issue that where there's actually kind of broad agreement that there's a problem that needs to be dealt with, from the sheriff to the people who are opposing the construction of the jail. So I'm trying to think about as we move forward to deal with this. How we kind of have a bigger sort of, I don't know if you want to call a public hearing or a commission or something as part of this process to really look at, what are the options for mental health and to involve a broader spectrum of people. Obviously the people in this room have a lot of experience, but people are mentioning, having people in law enforcement, I also think it would be important to have people who are on the other end of the system, who have experience of being in the system or have loved ones and so forth. So I'm just envisioning perhaps this is one thing we might offer to ILPP as something they might want to consider in terms of investigating this, because it's such a big and crucial piece to the whole system. Secondly, I think what you've brought forward, I mean, you've had this sort of overall philosophical thing, and then clearly the mental health piece is one place where it touches down. I think the pretrial is another place, and I think the downtown jail is another place where we have problems that have to be dealt with, and that those are also issues where a broad spectrum of people are kind of in agreement that something needs to be done, so that maybe those are like at least three issues where we could kind of focus our kind of recommendations. And in terms of the kind of caring for that philosophical approach, it seems to me that the coordinating council that Lynn has recommended is a body that could kind of that could carry that kind of philosophical message and to try to make sure that it doesn't, that the whole process doesn't get bogged down in nuts and bolts, but keeps trying to push toward a broader cultural change and spreading into other areas. So that's just a few kind of reflections on kind of trying to tie some of the stuff together that we've looked at so far.
And we've been doing a lot of talking about the mental health section of Julian's, which I think segues well into Mark and Sheila and Benita's thoughts.
Yeah, actually, I think we've kind of moved there. I mean, the number 24, the respite detox beds, I mean, it talks about the flexion or the prevention mode in terms of keeping people out. There is that in behavioral health, so that you're talking about both mental health and substance abuse, that you have existing systems that have some interaction already with the criminal justice system, but it needs to be broader. And that, I mean, essentially what we heard from the sheriff was in the jail, and as you described it, it's a bare minimum of mental health services that exist and are being provided. And for substance abuse, I believe it's non-existent from what I recall, that it was simply you had Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous coming in. And it's possible that maybe there is some substance abuse that's occurring through the mental health services that are provided there, but that also needs to be addressed. It needs to be some, as what's here is talking about getting some screening and assessment done. And yes, a person has to be open and willing to engage in treatment for it to be successful, but at least you have some sense of what the circumstances of the individual's contributing factor to their incarceration would certainly be the mental health or substance abuse issues. And in fact, I mean, they may be in there because of an arrest for possession or whatever.
Mark, can I ask you a question about that? Just to see if you're in, is it making sense when you talk about someone taking advantage of what's potentially available? What I feel is a realistic approach is that it would be good if we didn't simply rely on the person. When a person turns it down or doesn't seem interested in it, it's too easy to turn away and say, oh, well, they don't want it.
That's why we need
some sort of case manager, advocate, credible person.
That's developing a relationship.
Does that make sense in the context of what
you're talking about? I think I've got some information about our criminal justice contract, criminal justice and specialty courts contract. That program includes a case manager that... I don't know that this is how it actually functions, but the original intention was that initial contact would be made with that person while they're in jail. I think primarily what's happening is that person is coming through an assessment upon exiting, and they've had prior involvement with the the jail or the criminal justice system. So then they're assigned to this particular case manager. And then I think the primary point of contact occurs at Time Center, that there's a fair number of individuals. So behavioral health services need to be more integrated into within the jail in terms of contact and work to engage the client. I think I'm agreeing with your point that yes, that just because a person says no, that should not be the end of it. But you also have within both the substance abuse and, correct me if I'm wrong, Sheila, within the mental health services, that you have gaps in the services that have been created through state reduction, and that it's put pressures on those systems. And from the mental health board's perspective, by the limits of our own funding, there's only so much we can do to respond. At this point in time, we've got a fair investment in some services related to criminal justice, but we don't have aftercare that occurs. We don't have an outpatient substance abuse program for adults, at least not supported with local dollars. We don't have an outpatient counseling program for people with mental illness, at least it's funded with $7 million.
We probably need to.
You also have, in terms of like with substance abuse, a lot of their referrals are the result of involvement with the criminal justice system. That they're court ordered to get assessed and engaged in treatment. I'm thinking about like DUIs and things like that.
I just put aftercare down there just because right now we've just got coordination between the criminal justice officials and community service providers, but we need to make sure it's clear. Sometimes people leave the jail and they're done with the system. So, I mean, we've got to make sure that aftercare system is in place. And I'm sure maybe that's assumed in 23, but...
Well, and actually the criminal justice program that we fund is intended to work with folks as they're coming out of, coming out of incarceration, when they're being released. So as part of that is Sheila already mentioned, is the benefits engagement to get them, if they're Medicaid eligible or eligible for other entitlement programs, to get them re-enrolled. And that is one of the recommendations. Apparently, there's some changes that are occurring in state policy that. I don't understand it entirely, but that when a person comes in, their benefits are terminated, and now the state has changed that policy from termination to suspension. But that you have to have some notification of the system 30 days prior to the person's release to get their benefits, just to start the process to reinstate their benefits.
And we don't know what they're doing here?
No, I don't. I think it's a fairly recent change in policy. That information, I think, has been shared with, I think, the sheriff. So, but that's only recently. That was something that came out of a national conference.
Probably the other thing for the state, kind of the parking lot for the questions or advocacy work from the state level, is the ability to complete applications for Social Security or Social Security disability or public aid. It's just, it's a standard policy, well known from all the social service providers, that you always get told no, regardless of what the application contains. Every first application gets denied. It's just, I mean, we do 300-400 of them a year, and it's just clockwork. They get denied. And that really impacts people's ability to gain access to anything, even if it's not community elements. I mean, 708 board and the support from the board there to understand that how important benefits are for dental care, for physical health care, for medications. And it doesn't do us a lot of good to start treatments that people can't sustain. Right. And so and that's the other thing I think, you know, I didn't mention before, but even though the jail has medications that, you know, they're making choices for the not the newest, most looking at the efficacy of medications, the more expensive ones. If the person is involved with us, we can get the medications to them. And so there's some, you know, natural things that could kind of happen if we had some coordination. So.
What are you, you're saying that's not happening out?
Well, for people that are involved with us in terms of coordinating care for somebody, those are resources. It is very hard for somebody who's not doing well physically or mentally to even complete the application process. I mean, again, you need a peer navigator just to manage acquiring the benefits. But if the person is homeless and you're relying on an address, it even becomes more difficult. And I think if you're expecting someone to have a phone, you know, the complications just compound themselves.
Well, so. Your email address.
And so, you know, the coordination of care is a big piece of it. And then having enough people, you know.
You were, what Sheila's described is a process that can run years for the individual to get their benefits reinstated, either to get, you know, an application, you know, submitted, denied, go through an appeal process, and, you know, that the various stages that it is a very lengthy. And
in the course of the last 3 years alone, almost all grant funding has been cut from the social service continuum, whether you're talking about substance abuse or mental health. If a person doesn't have a medical card, services aren't available to them, or the agency can't bill for the services to keep the service going. So that's part of using local dollars in a way that makes the most sense. And this committee is seeing is narrowing it down, but also knowing that there are limited resources, which, you know, you want to have a best practice model that is evaluated and is through a continuous quality improvement cycle, because, you know, otherwise, we're using our limited resources in the not best way. So I think that all those pieces that are really important.
One of the other things that I identified was it's been a conversation internal to our office, is basically people with a developmental disability or traumatic brain injury, is that we really don't have a sense of how many folks that are coming through the jail fit that description, that there are persons with an intellectual disability, and that that there needs to be some screening process for that.
Screening.
So that you just, and it might fit, but I don't believe that there that population is being identified.
You don't think they're being screened, okay?
Yeah. And that, you know, there are, I believe, a screening instrument that is available. There's also the, and I don't know if they'd be willing to do it, but regional planning has a pre-admission screening program, the PASS program, that might be a possibility for doing that. And it would be on a referral basis, that if somebody within the jail responsible for intake believes this person is low functioning or has something, that they could refer to that, or it could be done as part of a screening and assessment process done for mental health and substance abuse, and then also looking at the question of intellectual disability.
I wonder if this is something we could flag in the consultant section, if we can crank this out. Again, you know, I don't know if it being sick picked or whatever, but if they aren't doing this, it means they aren't using a good risk assessment. This should be already there. So the consultant could be looking at their risk assessment screening process to see if they're using a state-of-the-art instrument.
And they may be, we just aren't aware of it.
But even if they're screening for this, beyond that, in terms of looking at, and maybe they're using the best, they're using the best tool, I don't know. But that would be something that the consultant should readily be able to determine, and because the tools are out there. So could I just go ahead and add that for a potential recommendation for the consultant in terms of priority, potential priority for consultant would be the screening, risk assessment tools. And by the way, I don't think that would be confined to the jail. I think our, because it also is this, you know, a lot of times people run through probation first, and if they aren't using the right tools to identify some of these deficits, then they're going to end up in jail down the road in any event. So I think that would be potential. Again, that's just something I'd like to put up there. Examining the assessments currently employed.
And I mean, running through all of this is, and it's actually the last recommendation, but I'll mention it now, is this question of system of care. And that you need to have strong services within the community to deflect a person and engage them prior to involvement with law enforcement. You know, but then once they're within the criminal justice system, that you have services that can begin or continue while they're incarcerated, and then also that follow them post-incarceration. Some of the other things that appear here, some are very specific. We talk about the crisis program, and that's already been touched upon. But there is training that occurs for police officers, and I think that's something actually Benita's very involved in. That is an important element for them to be able, and on first contact, recognize who they're dealing with.
Do we have that up here or no? So it'd be training for police officers in.
Yeah, it would be.
Prevention. I mean, in some ways it's broader coordination, but that's still an example. Yeah. So, is it training for police officers? How would you describe it?
It's a crisis intervention team training.
Okay, here we go. Crisis intervention.
Benita, could you talk a little bit about that for us?
For police officers.
The first thing about the crisis intervention training is they already have a team formed of local officers. And so they're always readdressing issues and acting out actual. They pay actors to act out different mental illness disorders and substance abuse disorders and how they respond. The problem is sometimes because it's a small amount of officers that are trained, that the first responders are not crisis trained officers. So we're trying to, because the CIT officers are out dealing with something else. And so the first responders are not equipped to actually work or get that person who's homicidal or suicidal to put down the gun, or they normally have a plan in place. And so to be able to talk them down. But they need the training to learn how to do it until the CIT officer actually comes in. So
this crisis intervention training is not system-wide. That we already have in place.
No, not all officers
are getting some form of this training.
Yeah, it is not.
Because we've talked, I believe it was the last meeting when we brought this up, and I think there was the question then that it's done, but how much was done? And it sounds like not enough.
Yeah. If all officers were trained in the CIT, that would be awesome.
And then only a few of them have maybe this, I'm finding on each team, have psychology background or counseling backgrounds. And so the active listening, the non-judgmental, all the skills that are involved in working with that individual is very difficult for some of them. So they need the training. So we've come up with some other forms of training that we're trying to implement to the community, which is mental health first aid.
And what I'm told by officers is that they frequently don't have an alternative place to. The current alternatives they have are limited with what to do. So the kind of things we were talking about of having a place that you were calling it respite, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Various options other than, you know, the police officer. Even if he takes somebody to the emergency room and then they find that the person's not an immediate danger to themselves or others, and they're out again, and he's got to deal with them again, and at some point the only alternative they have is to put them in jail because they have to deal with them. And they, I mean, so what, at least what I'm being told is there's not, there just isn't, there aren't enough options for the police officer. Even if they're trained, they need more options about what to do that would be an appropriate place for the person and the community to be safe, other than the jail.
Yeah, I think that's one possibility. Everybody trained in crisis intervention would be great, because then you would know what you could sort out from people not educated or maybe not trained or don't have the resources interpersonally to try to diffuse a situation with somebody who has a mental illness, for example. And sorting that out, right? Yeah. Sorting that out, mm-hmm. having a respite detox is an option, mm-hmm. but then you still may be faced with taking them into, let's say, into the jail. But then there's got to be a way that a police officer can help jumpstart mm-hmm. the mental health court or drug court right then.
Right.
So if they, you know, have to use that as a last resort,
right.
that whoever, if you go in that direction, that that's the immediate spot at which the screening would take place.
Well, if there are mental health advocates there, they could pick that up.
There are, but this is another situation about everybody has to be in agreement. The state's attorney
right.
has to be in agreement, the judge, the treatment
right.
team, and then the person has the ability to voluntarily choose or choose
right.
not to. And so you get kind of that piece where you can't mandate it, but you can court order alternative treatment too. We haven't done a lot of that here. You can actually court order medications, but again,
it's
the person
it's
still
not.
Has to be willing
yeah.
to do that. And we have some people who just depending on the situation, you can get court ordered to have a shot, and shot once a month versus minutes in every day.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of options for people. Some of them are favorable, some of them not so much, and I'm looking at Scott because I know that in the end, people have the right to say no. And so you do everything that you can and make sure that we have everything in our toolboxes, because then that group is the smallest it can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're, when you list all these programs here?
And they're not, it's, yeah, they're...
I mean, what I'm sort of trying to think about is I was trying to figure out how to read this or in terms of the kind of report that we want to give. I mean, one way one could look at this is, God, look at this. We have a tremendous number of resources in this community. What else do we need? An alternative way to present it is we do a number of things, and they meet some of the needs, but there's lots of gaps in the system, and there's lots of gaps for specific people and for specific needs, and some of them we've talked about. I think we have to specify what the gaps are, as well as what we
yeah,
have.
There are what I've laid out in terms of existing services and so forth. That's about, I think, the extent of it. And so, you know, the gaps that exist are, you know, not just within the services that are available within the jail, but also the capacity of the system in the community at large in terms of what they're able to do just for the community, that the services aren't adequate. A good example, and we make reference to it, is psychiatric care.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if you have insurance, you may be able to get in and see a psychiatrist, but it's very difficult.
Is that part of? Would that be number crunching coming from the task force, or would it be number crunching from the consultant in terms of saying, like you said, it could be this impression, oh, we have too many elements.
Well, it might be helpful
but saying
to, like,
within the criminal justice system itself, looking not just jail, et cetera, we've got either X percent or numbers or whatever who are just not receiving the level of care, not receiving care at all.
I mean, some people keep wait lists, but some people don't. I don't know that the consultants will be able to get to it. I mean, I can tell you right now, today, we have over 100 people
mm-hmm.
on the adult psychiatry wait list.
The one thing the consultant might be able to identify is within the jail system, you know, what number have required psychiatric care or were identified
or
as needing.
Or receiving treatment, they yeah. do know
so
that.
So could I just say maybe it's potential? I'm not saying, because the consultant might ask you guys to do number crunching, but potential to get, because we can say we need this, but maybe down the road the county board is going to say, but are you talking 30 or 100? And to start putting numbers to it and start to show the gravity of the problem, because I think so.
That was my point about capacity.
It's hard because
so a potential priority.
You also don't want to keep a wait list, I mean, for the same reason.
Consultant would be the numbers in terms of gaps in services. Is that what we would say? The numbers underserved or not served? Numbers.
Well, because we should specify.
How does that fit in, though, with the consultants?
But they'd have to be within the criminal.
Right.
Yeah, so needing psychiatric care.
It would only be referral, follow-up, how to move people maybe out quicker or have services delivered. So, like, for example, we would see any of our clients that were incarcerated can do follow-up with our physician, for example. That sheriff can bring them to us or
well, there's a concrete example that Michael gave where they said the sheriff says, at any one time, he has X number of people for whom he needs. He has no place to send them. They don't for mental health services. I mean, just even noticing that.
People could be waiting for half time.
The number who've been committed to the state is 8 to 10. He didn't say, but I assume the number would be even bigger at any one time of people who should be getting services in their jail but aren't. And often, these are the kind of people who are in their solitary confinement too.
Well, so. And they're two. I mean, they're different kinds. Some people waiting for forensic bad, for example, or someone waiting for a civil commitment bad in terms of. But so the hospital is the same.
And then also even with pretrial services, Bloomington doesn't do it, or the county doesn't do that. But I mentioned the model from Milwaukee where pretrial services includes that component, special program for mentally ill people who would otherwise be incarcerated. So what's that number? And then even if we were to adopt that, which I personally feel is, it sounds like we don't have the structure right now. Not the structure. We don't have just the people, the money to actually provide those support services.
I could not tell you. I haven't heard, but I assume the sheriff keeps up with the number of people on the average daily census who are getting some sort of mental health care. They certainly make it sound like on any given day, they have any number of people that they're trying to get some medication into where they're being forced to keep in solitary confinement or whatnot.
Monitoring, yeah.
So that you know, the consultant probably could get that you know, crunch those numbers related to the volume, the number of folks in the jail, and then their level of mental health need. And then, I guess, you know, that also would be, I don't know if they would have that necessarily for substance abuse, but obviously there's co-occurring disorder.
Anything else you guys wanted to talk about?
There were a couple of state recommendations. It's related to the funding. There's the question of like the in terms of just general advocacy in relation to behavioral health care support, financial funding. States not only, I guess, moving entirely to essentially just Medicaid, but also then restricting eligibility for Medicaid-supported services. And then you also have the pressure that other cuts are having on other aspects of the social service system. So, I mean, there, you know. So
you want, Mark, how should I capture this? A potential state recommendation dealing with cuts in social services?
Yes. Yeah, cuts in social services and specifically behavioral health care.
Well, where does that fit in our, I'm sorry.
I think there was going to be a section about advocacy to the state.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It's time to.
Recommendations for state action. That would probably be in our final report. Probably not.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that, you know, that I think is important is around facilities. And Mark, I think Alex said it very well in terms of making sure no matter what space is being considered, that it was adequate for the delivery of care, because it would be really nice to be able to go into the jail and deliver it, but we all know that downtown it's not conducive to groups, it's not conducive to individual sessions with anybody. And so whatever is designed around how to bring services into the jail while people are there to sort of enhance the aftercare and the follow-up, we need to have space to do that. I mean, for the providers, whoever they may be, needs to be conducive to that treatment and engagement focus.
And before we leave this section, actually, I should let you go, Mark.
There was also a specific recommendation or two. One was in regards to an existing Department of Justice contract award that supports some expansion services for drug court, and that will expire essentially a year from now. And I believe, and I think if you were to talk to Judge Ford or the drug court team, they would say that those services, that expansion has been worthwhile, and that there's some mechanism for supporting that is needed.
Is it possible that we can pursue more federal funding for it?
I think it's probably got, and I don't know, I'd have to look at it, but I believe it's probably got a sustainability, so that I don't know that you could get a renewal for it. But the expectation is that it would be continued through other non-federal sources. And I found that the discussion earlier about the quarter-cent sales tax and the percentage allocation very interesting in regards to that question.
This is something that I'm pretty confident would be eligible. That's actually great you brought that up, because that's what I wanted to talk about. Before we moved on, I wanted to talk about drug court, mental health court, and other diversion programs, Luke and Scott, and ask you guys how well you think they're working, if people are looking at it, how can we improve it, what challenges are there besides the fact that, like I said, the county's still broke, and maybe talk about that a little bit. I think these programs are the a main direction that we want to go in and build on that. So let's talk about what we already have in place and what we think about that.
I think drug court, the folks that are referred to that, from my understanding is that they have had multiple contacts, police contacts, multiple stints in the jail or DOC, and that they're on their way back and they end up in drug court. And I think the program, it graduates folks on a regular basis. They graduate probably 10% of who they have in the program at any time. And from our view, from the Mental Health Board, and we're a primary funder, from the Mental Health Board's perspective, I would say we view that program as a successful one. But the question that's come up, at least for me, is, and we've talked about it already, is aftercare. Is that once they graduate, services will continue for a period of time, say while they're still on probation. But once they're off probation, the services end, and there's not necessarily a program or a funding mechanism to support their continued engagement, be it case management or involvement in treatment, unless they have their own wherewithal. And that could be either them being on Medicaid or some other type of...
It wasn't clear to me, maybe you know from looking at the data, how many people are served by this over in a given time period?
There's about 100. I'd have to look at it, but I'd say there's probably about 100 folks in drug court at this time. Maybe more.
So any period, over how long are people in it for?
They have to be substance free for a 12-month period. Typically there's a relapse or two within there, so they will be in the program anywhere from 12 months to 2 years, I'd say. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be probably 18 months average.
So
if they complete the program and actually graduate.
at any one time, you're thinking there are 120 people who are in the program?
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to look. You know, I get reports on the, on those numbers in terms of who's in drug court. And we seem to think that it's about 120. Yeah.
And do we need more?
Well, yeah.
Or do we have? Does this adequately meet?
I think that would be a question for Judge Ford or the courts about that. It's Judge Ford does drug court, Judge Ford does mental health court. So, I think at some point you reach a limit to how much the man can do. I think he is very, very supportive of the program. I mean, obviously very supportive of the program. And believes in its value and the impact it has had on people's lives.
There's also the net widening risk where we start saying, oh, well, that person, it's a drug crime, so throw them into drug court, and they really don't need that level of service, and it's still very expensive compared to other community alternatives. And there sometimes is a propensity to do that because it can make the numbers look better for the program if you get somebody who doesn't really have a serious problem. So that's actually something as a kind of a question I have about the program here, because you want to make sure we aren't, and it sounded like what you were saying, we aren't skimming the surface.
No, these folks some will go from drug court out of jail into residential treatment. Then from there, step down to intensive outpatient, and then just regular outpatient, and then also be receiving case management. There is a coordinated team approach. So if the person is also identified as possibly having a co-occurring disorder, a mental illness, they'll be screened for that, assessed for that, and if the assessment indicates such, the community elements team will become engaged.
So when you discuss this, it's just listening. It sounds to me like, well, we have pretty much what we need. Is that wrong?
Well, I
have this feeling it's wrong.
We have the continuum in place, but it's going to need resources. For example, when that grant falls away, in order to keep the capacity, we're going to have to look locally as well as maybe some other opportunities at the state or federal level. But the same is true as mental health court grows. It'll continue to need more resources as more people.
That's considerably smaller now, right?
It's just started where drug court is what, in its 11th year now.
So
mental health court is in its second. And if you look at the progression of both of those, they just kind of grew over time. And so we suspect that that's the same trajectory. If you talk to Judge Ford, he's like very pleased with mental health court, and it's increasing, and you're starting to get people knowing about the system within the attorney's world.
You're still seeing, just to answer your earlier question, drug court, I don't know really, it's not really a matter of funding yet, because it's actually a very narrow parameters for who can be in it. You don't want violent offenders, you can't have drug dealers in there, because that would just be a disaster. And you also have to have people that are considered eligible for it, and the fact that they might be able to deal with this, with the discipline that it imposes, particularly the way Judge Ford does it. If you've ever gone, it's every Monday they come in, you go before the judge, you have to hand up how many meetings you've gone to, what you've done, and if you have had any kind of slip-ups or haven't found work, whatever it is, you're going into jail for the most part. So there's a lot of discipline there, but you also have to actually have the fear of going. It can't be your first offense. You've had to have a lot of, otherwise there's no real fear, and people would all say, well, why don't I just have regular probation, which is much less demanding than drug court is. What I've noticed, though, about, I'd ask the drug court person how many they have in right now. They said about 75, including, and I think the number of reasons it fluctuates is, once you graduate, there's considered an alumni group, and that is now it's on their own initiative. But yeah, it's the great idea of one, it shows people in the program that there's life beyond the program, and two, it gives the people, when you graduate, you're not just on floating on an island. Now you're allowed to come back. But mental health, one thing I've been disappointed with is a lot of
defense attorneys don't seem to know what it is.
Right.
There'll be cases where it's very clear to me that the guy, you know, that I had a case recently right in front of Champaign Police Department where a man was sitting on a guy's car. He just would walk in the street, sat on his car, wasn't doing anything else, but literally didn't know where he was. And so what do you do with that guy? You put him in jail. He's never going to post bond. I mean, I don't think he had a home. And so we kept saying, let's send him to mental health court. And he had a series of these kind of runs. And the defense attorney just kept, you know, not responding. And then finally, we realized that he just didn't know what it was and didn't want to ask us what it was. So month after month, he's trying to continue it for one reason or another. Well, most of the time, he's in jail. His client's in jail for that time. So at that point, you're like, well, you could just, you know, plead the case out because he's got so much time in, you know, credit for time in. Well, that's not solving anything because he's going to come out and do the exact same thing in a few months. So it's getting the word out on mental health court, which I think is so, you know, drug, and they're doing a good job, I think, in
the
sense.
If we can get them early screened on the front end. Then
exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't, as, you know, our couple of our folks at work, it doesn't stop you from us calling. Like I said, you just call the public defender and tell them what you do and how you can help.
Yep. And that's what we finally realized. Public defenders, and some of them are the same way. They don't seem to, but they, at least they have so much volume.
Right.
And so now I have this, you know, cut and paste. Here's the guy you talk to and Ed and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because sometimes they just don't want to admit they don't know, especially defense attorneys that are getting paid and they want to pretend like they know what's going on. But most of them, I think, already
do. You have
to
somehow make it easier for them.
I guess so. But, you know, I think with drug court was the same way. With each graduation, with each nice piece of the paper, people's awareness is a little bit bigger and it's more accepted. And I think you'll see the same thing with mental health. So I think, you know, it's good to have Judge Ford in that for that reason.
And I just want to make a comment about the drug court and the mental health court. Even though I grew up in this community, I left, came back, I know a lot of people. And taking my community elements hat off to say this, though the drug court has been beneficial because I'll hear comments when I'm out in the community speaking, people talking. The repeat offender, this one particular guy was repetitive offender. He had mental illness and he had substance abuse. And he's gone through drug court and someone's just waiting on him to relapse. It's been the second year, the third year, and now he is sponsoring for someone else. And so not only that, I've seen a female do that. And so even by word of mouth and them seeing how these people react. And then James Winston sits and tells them in the paper how many repetitive times he was in and how much the program. He has a barbershop over here somewhere. He has gone on with his life. So those people have been able to help the other people about the programs and everything that was put in place. So the community is now being aware, especially the African-American community, of the program and the benefits of it. And when we talk about recidivism, that is one program that is helping people stop going back and forth to jail.
I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, I've not been involved in the Champaign County one. But I ran the one in McLean County, the drug court there, and it is rewarding for that reason, and that it changed people's philosophy.
Yes.
It's not so much of what we've seen, I think we've seen with public participation, is it's seen as law enforcement versus people who are in the system. And this is one of those things where there's no one harder on, if someone relapses, than other people in the drug court program.
Right.
And what it does is it gives them a support network that they're lacking on the outside, and they haven't, a lot of them have never had before, a family and people who care about them and people that are found when they mess up. And so that, and if there's one thing you can really take from that is in all our programs, finding a way to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I really liked your idea earlier with, it doesn't have to be necessarily, and I of course like the pretrial in its own way, but the reason pretrial works in McLean County, for example, is it's someone who is on them right away, who cares, who's interested in them, who, a lot of these, you know, it isn't just protecting the public when we think about bond. It's also securing their presence in court and making sure they show up.
Absolutely.
Well, a lot of these guys, if you're homeless, if you have no phone, if you don't have a book you're carrying with you to keep your appointments, and so it's a matter of, you know, they forget in a month. They don't come back, and then you're going to go into jail, and your bond's never mail posted. So some kind of way to kind of get to them early to be accountable to have some accountability there and to kind of reminding them and shepherding through. But it also has the same kind of element of support that the drug court unit has, I think, has really done a good job of. So I think that's a really interesting idea.
It's a potentially relatively low cost.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I don't think, and I'll just say this, and I would like a lot of what I would like to do in the report is kind of discussing the pretrial issues. But I will say the issues that McLean County has after working on both of them and why they need pretrial is not the same reason we would want it. I did arraignment court today. Everyone who was arrested last night got before a judge today, had bond set today. In McLean County, they won't be arraigned on their charges for about 2 weeks. So it's that two-week period that pretrial services came in to try to see, all right, can we get people bonded out before they get a public defender 2 weeks later? Champaign actually addresses that quite well. There are still people that fall through the cracks, but it's not nearly like it is in that county. But the element of, you know, somebody getting involved and keeping up with these people who are on the fringe of maybe they don't need to be monitored 24, but they'll be gone or they'll have mistakes or they'll maybe relapse if it's a substance issue. That, you know, and there's only two people in McLean County that handle the whole thing and write these reports. If you don't have to be doing those kind of reports, you just need somebody to kind of keep in contact with the people. Uh-huh. I think you could easily do it with two or three people.
Well, the general model for lots of vulnerable people, which I generically use the term. I think you used a different. You said put a peer advocate. You know, I was thinking case manager. Well, that's a more professionalized title. But the idea that there's some human being who's advocating for and working with this vulnerable person throughout as they negotiate this really complex system. I mean, life, you know, for most of these people, life is too complicated and too many things to figure out. And if there's a contact with a person they have a relationship with, they trust enough, it's not going to work for everybody, but you could really solve a lot of difficulties for many people that would prevent them from getting in further difficulties.
Well, that would be the same model with this, because peer court graduates provide some of that peer support, peer, and they're going into the community and telling their friends, their family, and their neighbors that this worked for them. It takes a while to ingrain it, but that's the cultural change we're talking about, too, so being patient and let that kind of
I also think that in certain, there's a certain mindset where you just distrust people in law enforcement, and that doesn't stop police officers. Okay, I see it every day when some of the best trial attorneys I've ever seen are public defenders, and I'll hear their attorneys say, "I'm going to get a real lawyer next month." Whatever it is, if you work for the government, you're considered to be, you know, on the same side as that. So the idea is the public defenders, the probation officers, all these people are on the same team. So I think there would be a certain element of informality and credibility that they would get if it wasn't even a probation officer, but someone who, you know, who kind of been through the experience or at least was aware of these things. Mm-hmm. Probation, the one thing I really liked about drug court was you would see, we'd all be on the team, they would hug the probation officers who work with them every day. And that's a little unusual, but then they get to us, even the public defenders, and it would be a handshake. We're more formal, and then you get to the judge, and you don't touch them at all. But that process you see, like, you almost get your feelings kind of hurt. Like, why don't we have the relationship that they have? Well, part of it is they're there every day, and they've worn down those barriers. So they're much more willing to say, I had a relapse. You wouldn't even have to test them. I had a relapse this weekend, and here's what would happen. And there's that trust element there. And so I kind of like, that's why I said I like the idea of having someone in a peer group who said maybe they're not considered to be part of that same system. They might actually be more forthcoming and listen to them and buy into it a little bit more.
But they'd still be trained, right?
They'd absolutely,
then let's
yes.
put trained up
See.
Here.
And they could be,
and trained cadres. Mm-hmm.
They could even be under court services or probation department. Mm-hmm. I just think it would be, you know, they'd be the carrot more than the stick, I guess is a way to say it. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be, oh, you messed up, which is what court services often can be.
Right.
But they can also be, you know, it's all showing them more like, all right, here's just what all the options are. I had no idea when we've gone through these how many options there are. And I should know how many options there are. It's just, there's just not that many people that know all the programs we have available here. To a large degree, it isn't that I think we don't have enough programs. I just don't think people know about all the programs or know how to even get started in any of these programs.
It's very complex.
So, it absolutely is. And so I think that's a lot of it. It's just kind of showing people arts. Step one, two, three. It's assessing what your needs are and how do you get in there. And I think that would be, I would solve a lot of the problems in our county.
Knowing what the eligibility criteria are, knowing what the requirements for the program, so you can make an informed decision about it. Yeah, absolutely. I think those are complicated, even for people who are working in it.
That's right.
Well, the only thing I don't want us to lose sight of is because sometimes one of the reasons why there are cost issues is not only because of the high cost of incarceration, but also because of the overutilization sometimes of more expensive community sanctions. So I know for the population, we are particularly concerned about those who are mentally ill and those with serious substance abuse problems. You know, they might have to be, you know, have a court supervision element to them. But when we say we have most of the programs, we don't have most of the community sanctioning options. We have very few. We have very few. And that, at the end of the day, when the judge is sitting there going, what do I sentence you to? Well, I sentence you to jail. I sentence you to prison. I like that because the state's going to pay 100%. I sentence you to probation. We don't even have intensive supervision probation. And they don't have short-term, cheap alternatives, like go work in the local garden, grow some food for poor people from your neighborhood, give it to the poor, do something constructive, and then there's this wraparound services if you need certain ones to get to help get your life in order. So I think that's a piece of it that I would encourage us not to overlook, because if we're going to have more expansive services, we're going to have to figure out where we need a smaller system and a quicker system and yet meaningful.
I think the point about jobs and job creation, if it's a sanction or part of a vocational plan for someone to reenter, those are essential. I think that seems pretty clear that we don't have a lot here. And so that's a pretty big gap.
Back to just drug court and mental health court, and particularly drug court, because mental health court is just beginning. There are costs associated with that program that are borne by, like, the state or the mental health board. And I'm thinking about, like, with the state, when somebody goes to residential treatment, that's a cost that's not is borne by the state. So there's with the financial condition the state is in, and it goes back to our, I guess, number 34. That there are risks to existing services that exist through the continued financial crisis the state is confronted with. And then for a last point, so we can move on, is I don't know that we have a recommendation up there about evidence-based, or evidence-informed practice, and the other half of that would be fidelity to the model. So that you have appropriate training and supervision and evaluation to ensure the fidelity to whatever models are applied.
Plus training supervision.
Well, if we thought about that system-wide, what would be desirable, but who knows if it's affordable or even something that people would understand is worthwhile, it would be very useful to have some sort of office of evaluation in which there were really a handful, you know, one or two professional people and some staff, but people who are capable of taking a look at these programs and evaluating them in light of, you know, questions of fidelity. It is a really important issue. That's what I was saying. All those programs in the literature that people say work, they always say they can work if they're done, if they're implemented properly.
Right.
You can have them, but if they're not implemented properly, and the only way you know, you can rarely know that from the self-reports of people who are doing the program. I hate to say that, but, you know, everybody's blinded by their own what they're doing. And so it's useful to have some sort of mechanism for an ongoing assessment.
Would you foresee, though, that they would then go to be, like, for example, they'd just be in the jail every morning? When would you catch them to do the risk assessment? Would you do it every day at that first stage before they even go in front of the judge? Or would you have it just sometime while the case is pending? When would you, I mean...
You're talking about the person assessment of the people, of the individuals?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, there, I think, you know, Lynn had some thoughts about, you know, assessment at right at the beginning, right? When people are first entering the system, there's...
Well, I'm really...
There's an intake process when somebody's brought into the jail.
Right.
That there'd be a screening, a short screening tool that's done.
Okay.
For the juvenile detention center, it's the youth, the YASI, youth assessment screening instrument or something. And that you would use something similar to that.
Okay.
For evaluation, can I put forensic internal and external? Because you still, internally, you always evaluate what you're doing. Can I do better?
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
But just for now, put internal and external.
Sheila Scott was asking about, in terms of screening or whatever, like, at what point would you do that with somebody being brought into the system? And what I described was similar to what I'm thinking of PLL, but the use of the YASI once they're brought to the juvenile detention center, and that's just simply part of the intake process. Would you?
Yeah, I mean, we have a simple intake screening form for adults. And actually, for anybody who calls in, and then we have walk-ins. Our point of access can be any of our locations, including the phone. And so that can start a service for us. We wanted to break down as many barriers as we could. And so that's why I think maybe, you know, one of the things, every time I come here, I think of things that, you know, we can check on. And that's the interface between the folks at the mental health folks in the jail and us to make sure that when somebody hits the jail and they have a screening form that they use for all new people, mm-hmm. once it's identified they have a mental health issue, and we should get involved at that point. And I think Mark's, you know, was asking or talking a little bit about where it's most often that we have interaction with them. And you know, a lot of the folks who are discharged and they find themselves, they're homeless at the time center. So it's possible a lot of the males are contacted there, for example. We have our, and I think it's referenced in the document, MRT started. So the mental health folks are doing that in the jail, and they've had some barriers to get people motivated to continue there, and also our groups at the, you know, at the agency. But again, that's a program that's just in its infancy. The funding and the sheriff and our agency trained a whole bunch of people, so I think we've got to kind of get it underway, get it going, and then find out, do the evaluation to see where we're missing people, and kind of kick that off a little bit better. So lots of work still to be done.
Okay. So. We've talked about a lot, but Lynn, your report was very thorough. We missed anything?
Well, I think. It particularly bears noting, doesn't matter what it's called. It used to always be called a community corrections board, but I gave it a different name just because I believe it goes beyond just community corrections. So I called it the restorative justice, maybe it's too long if I can't remember. Champaign County Restorative and Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. Restorative Justice. Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. And as you will note, I had recommended, and it's not really my recommendation, that research shows that these community corrections boards will only work if they're broad-based. But you need a structure in place to do the things that we've talked about, to make sure that this isn't just an ad hoc thing, the fad of the moment, but to make sure that there is ongoing training, that there's ongoing evaluation, and that there is an ongoing assessment of how can we do things better. And the beauty of this process is this, is we can come up with the best ideas in the world, but we are not the people in power. And you get the people in power, plus the public, plus the service providers, and you start to see change happen. And what I have seen happen is usually you'll have at least one very powerful person within the system who's particularly opposed to change. But the beauty of these boards is you start seeing people working together, in some ways kind of neutralizing that person, and then eventually that person will come on board. Now, I'd like to think, I'll be idealistic and optimistic, that all key constituencies, the defense bar, prosecution judges, the service providers, et cetera, will be all in favor of some of the most basic ideas, because things like pretrial services, this is very basic. This is not controversial. It's not rocket science. But, again, it's change, and people tend to, one, be resistant to change, and two, they'll be defensive. And that's why it's very important that we couch this in terms of not a criticism, but we're building upon things that people have spent a lot of time building in this county. But you'll note that I set forth, drawn from, you know, recommendations of professional organizations, groups that are out there, and what I felt would be a good balance in terms of the people who could serve on that kind of council. And then, so again, I've got that up there, and then there's some recommendations, sub-recommendations, I guess you might say, that there would be, we are going to have, I think, a lot of very helpful recommendations for the county. But even this council can't do all the work. So, for example, for pretrial services, to have a subcommittee comprised of certain key individuals, and then also not see certain key members of the council, but also some people who aren't even on the council, to fill in the details. Because as you mentioned, you can have the program, but it's got to be well structured. It's the devil's in the details, and the angels are in the details. So I listed some subcommittees that I thought, so that you'll note that there's the reentry planning and integrated programming subcommittee. This committee could, for example, be looking at how to approach systemically the issue of addressing the behavioral needs of the people in the system. But in any event, so I'm recommending that there be that council. And then that what would be presented to that council, and then there would be a lot of kind of, I guess we'd have to say, the task force would hopefully continue to advocate for these changes, and then also there'd be community advocacy and the like, that certain of our recommendations would be finally implemented by the council. And I identified several that I thought were priorities. We've already talked about pretrial services, and I did feel that it is important for us to, I love the recommendation that we should have expansive list of community sanctions. That's where we want to head. But I do think that it would be helpful for us to highlight what we think would be most important in terms of, and I want to talk right now about sanctions. Because if I'm a judge, I'm going to impose a sentence, or, you know, there may be some some kind of pre-adjudication options. But for those who are convicted, I'm going to impose a sentence. And as I mentioned, there are not many alternatives in this community. And so I mentioned some that I felt would be priorities to me. We can disagree, but the ones that I do believe in restorative justice, day reporting centers are out there. I'm recommending that we have a restorative justice center, and that way people can come in for the typical purpose of day reporting centers. There's one place where often they can come to get some of those centralized services we've talked about. But we call it a restorative justice center because there could be a victim-offender mediation occurring there. People could show up, do their 2 weeks of, afternoons for 2 weeks, working in a garden, producing local food for the poor, the people in the nursing home, or whatever. It's a meaningful sentence, but then when they're done, there may be aftercare but they're done. We aren't paying for a probation officer to continue to supervise them, because there's also a cost that comes with that too. If they have a 3-year probation sentence, if they mess up, they get pulled into the system again. And a lot of times they really don't need to be, quite frankly. So I think there's a lot of hidden costs to probation that are sometimes not recognized. The Restorative Justice Center was something that I would recommend as a priority. I have heard that electronic sentences are not common here. Once again, we don't want to widen the net where it doesn't need to be, but I think there's some potential there instead of incarceration. But there may be some roadblocks in the law that's been mentioned to us, but we haven't gotten any specifics. And then finally, I had mentioned day fines as a priority simply because, once again, it gets over quickly. For those people who don't need a level of supervision, an intensive level of services, we're trying to get fewer people, in some ways, in the system so there can be the resources expended on, first of all, those who are violent, the ones we're scared of. We need the resources for those. And then the ones who need the services, like mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, so we don't see them again. So I guess in terms of mine, I would say, and again, we can debate this later, but I feel we should identify priorities for community sanctions at the outset with the goal of having an expansive list. The analogy I always give is, what would we think of a medical care system if somebody went to a hospital and they say, well, you have two options. You can have open heart surgery, or we can deliver your baby. But wait, I have cancer, or I have, you know, this and that. I mean, there's a range of options for medical problems, and we need a range of sentencing options. So the ones that I would like to put on the list that would be the Restorative Justice Center, because I do feel when we talk about cultural shifts, if we start talking about not always focusing on getting back at the offender, but focusing on having the offender give back to the community, because the criminal behavior has hurt our community. It's fractured the bonds of our community. But restorative justice is a healing process. I really believe in that. Expanded electronic supervision where needed. And then the day fines. And then I think...
Is there a function of, I guess, pretrial services?
These are sanctions. Pretrial services is already in there.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, in terms of, you know, the appropriateness of those community sanctions, is that a function of pretrial services in terms of a recommendation to the judge?
That's another way of saving money that we can point out in our report, is that a pretrial services program does the screening, and then some of that work goes into the pre-sentence investigation process, so it saves time and money for the probation department. But pretrial services focus on those people who have not been convicted of a crime.
Okay.
And then these are those who have been, when I say sanctioned, they've been convicted. Okay, so that's a convicted. And I think we had pretrial services up there, so I didn't, repeat that. I talked about, so those were the three that I mentioned in one section, but then I also, there were two others. One would be more sentencing options that are specially tailored to those with mental health and substance abuse problems. So for example, the expanded community residential option. But I didn't flesh out those details because that falls within all of your expertise. But I put that expanded options for offenders with substance abuse and health problems. And then I had that overarching recommendation to incorporate and integrate restorative justice into the system, but then in keeping with that, I said, let's think about restorative sentences. A restorative sentence can be, and a lot of times this is in cooperation with nonprofits, but to have somebody work with Habitat for Humanity, six different weekends or something, building a house in a poor area. And that's, but there's also some training involved, so it's not supposed to be just community service. They're supposed to, it's combined with some other things. So the other, I think, recommendations mostly have been addressed and come up. You know, we need for availability and integration of the substance abuse programming, mental health programming, training, evaluation, and public education. I think that's, I added it kind of on my own because I heard people kind of making those points, but Nina, I think you were talking about this, and where there was training of criminal justice officials and defense attorneys about services, drug court alternatives, systemic improvements. I also think public education is really important for a lot of reasons, because we can get ideas from the public, because they need to be, the public needs to understand restorative justice for it to work, because the public can be, I think one reason this task force got formed is because the public doesn't know really about the criminal justice system, and then they hear, oh, we're just going to add on to the jail, and they really don't know that there are a lot of, they just don't know what's going on. It just seems so easy to add on to the jail. So this is a big piece of it. I think as the public gets educated, all of a sudden they say, wait a second, you know, there's got to be a better way. So I think public education is, and that needs to be, we talked about a cultural change. That transparency can come through that. And then a subcommittee within the council would be the public education subcommittee. So again, that becomes kind of embedded in the system instead of kind of ad hoc efforts. We've got a few people in our community that, and I'm not talking about you, but a few members who come to our meetings and maybe are very knowledgeable, but I don't think the community is as a whole. So I think that's pretty much it. I mean, there's lots of stuff at the end in addition, but I think that's
it. Could I just pick up on your last point here? What you're really talking about, as I understand this, and then you've made some very specific suggestions, which are great. What you're talking about are alternatives that the sentencing judge can believe in. That is, so therefore, the alternative has to be feasible. The community has to be engaged with this, providing this option for the judge. The judge has to then know about it and believe in it.
Right.
At some point in this process, and I'm not sure what this point, where this point is, we, or the consultants, or the county board, or some group, need to involve the judges in this conversation.
Right.
I mean, I don't think judges are likely to I don't think judges will respond to simply us telling them what they ought to do. I think they have to somehow be invited into the process so that they can become a part of the reasoning. And then I think they can have tremendous effects on the system. So in some ways, the changing of the culture really involves the engagement of the judges in thinking. I know there's a whole way of thinking of which I'm sure you know, but therapeutic jurisprudence. It's a whole different way of thinking about what the criminal justice system is. And that does require, though, that judges are willing to view it this way. I don't know
but
quite
how. That's the beauty of the council. Because, for example, in Milwaukee, it was a prosecutor who pulled the judges in. And now the judges are.
Yeah, somebody, in some way, the judges have to be brought in as engaged in this process of planning.
I should tell you that I do believe, and I'll put this down as a recommendation, that, and this is pretty easy. My feeling is we should have a preliminary report because we want to get some things out there for the consultant, et cetera, and then flesh them out. But I do feel that we need to have in the appendix, we can get and this would be national data on that shows the cost effectiveness of some of these options, and that would be their cost, and then recidivism data. And when you look at it, it's just compelling. You say, on average, nationally, it costs this much to keep somebody in jail versus this much.
I'd be really surprised if the consultants don't have already boilerplate information available.
We can just tender some recommendations here, and then we ask the consultants to give some of those numbers that show how much money can be saved. And then when we say saved, and then used more effectively, either for longer sentences for certain violent offenders, but for the services you're talking about, and the like. But I do think, you know, all of this is good, but at some point we're going to have to do number crunching. And I don't think yet, quite frankly. Unless we want to wait 2 years to do it, or a year to give some recommendations. So that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, we've come up with 42 ideas. We've got a lot to chew on. We have one more scheduled meeting. We can certainly add to that. Some of the things we talked about at the last meeting, the county board's going to have to bring up at the justice section. It's going to be after our next meeting, but at the beginning of October. Things like extending, adding new members so people can talk, things like that. So I don't have anything to report on that because we have not had that since then. But we I haven't heard any challenges to extending the mandate, so this committee can keep meeting with, can work with the consultant. So I don't think that's a problem. But as it is, we can schedule more meetings in October. Right now, we've got our 42 ideas. We had talked a little bit about bringing in some service providers and talking about something of that. But it seems to me Sheila, Mark, and Benita's report kind of covers that. So I guess I will throw it out. Is there anybody else, anybody feels like we need to bring in before we keep working towards some recommendations for the consultant and for the board?
Well, just in light of the last thing I was talking about and you were suggesting here, I don't even know who are there judges that we could bring in? Who are the proper
Judge Ford would be the one who would be my first thought because he takes such an active interest in this.
Judge Ford has been invited. I don't remember if there was a conflict. The court's administrator has been here at least once,
right.
Possibly twice. But I remember Roger coming in at least once.
Yeah.
Who's the judge that sets the sort of chief judge who sets the policies of the way the...
Judge Stefanos is the chief judge.
Yeah.
But the two judges that I think would be the best for this would be Judge Klaus, who is an associate judge, but by many considered to be a chief judge in waiting, kind of. He also does all the arraignment courts. He sets all the bond for people as they come in. And he's very influential in that way. Judge Ford is a circuit judge, but he's taken a lot of initiative to start the drug court, to do the mental health court. And I think anything outside of the traditional probation or DOC time seems to be under Judge Ford's kind of purview. He's the only one that really seems to take an interest. Or I should say he takes the initiative to look at third or additional options.
So I'm wondering, I mean, if we were really trying to encourage a culture change and encourage a system view, we'd want to think of ways to get other judges interested in the way Judge Ford is.
Well, isn't one of our options, do we feel we know enough now to, again, whether we want to say, whether it goes, it doesn't have to go to the county board, to put together some preliminary recommendations that somehow can then get to the consultant. And then we run those recommendations, like for example, I mean, I'd actually like to hear from Judge Ford, but whether it's some group that's focusing particularly on mental health and substance abuse issues, first meeting with him or whatever, but having in some ways meetings with certain people, you know, Joe Gordon has asked me to come over there and I need to talk to him. But I guess what I'm saying is I know, I've done a needs assessment before, and I can see how we could spend 9 months to a year continuing to gather information. But I also know this consultant is coming on board soon, and I really would like that I've seen consultant reports before, and quite frankly, what you folks have all written together, a consultant report typically would say, you need
yes,
to
of
do
course.
This, this, and this. And we need, that's why I feel we can put a lot of this together. We may have a lot of numbers here, but a lot of it fits together tighter than you might imagine. Put it together. It's preliminary. Again, has to be some way that is just some...
Well, here's what my...
And then we get to consulting.
Here's my process. Here's my comment about that.
Yeah.
And you're right that we have to have a report, and I'm not disagreeing at all that we should do the report and so on. I think we should also be thinking about this as a process. I think we have more, there's a greater likelihood that whatever report we come up with will matter if people in the system feel that they are a part of it, rather than just having a report that then can be filed and we could say we did it and there it is. And so I'm thinking of involving, I'm wanting to talk with, and it's less about people reporting to us the way we have so far. We needed information, and it was good to have people come and talk and so on. But I think we're getting close to the point where it seems to me that we might start thinking about how to be effective in the process of moving this to reality rather than only as a report. So my thought about the judges is simply to say, it would be good, is there a way to get the judges involved so that they're favorable toward this task force report because they see their own ideas reflected and that it feels right for them? Because I think if they just see it as a report in which they have no investment, we're less likely to have the report taken seriously.
I think it's not just the judges, though. I think I've done this with victim offender mediation. The first time I proposed this to the ABA, the judges didn't like it, the prosecutors were opposed, the defense attorneys were opposed, and the victims were opposed. That's just everybody. So then we got an expert on victim offender mediation, and we got somebody who'd gone through it, whose daughter had been murdered, and then it got through the ABA. So I don't see it just as the judges. I see it as defense attorneys. I see it as the prosecutor's office. I see it as, right now, I actually see it in terms of party lines. I think we need the Democratic caucus to understand. I think the Republican, because for whatever reason, I read in the paper that the Republicans were all opposed to hiring this consultant. So I think that's part of our strategy to make sure that the caucuses are, that we get input and that there's the education. So I like your idea that we look at not only how can the timetable and the process for getting the work done, but also then what's the process for making sure that we get the support so it actually makes a difference. I think that's savvy.
Maybe that's something we need to talk with the consultants about too. They're figuring out how to get everybody on board with this. But I mean, from my thinking is we actually have the prosecutor's office involved, like for real. And I think my impression maybe is incorrect. I think we could have the public defender's office involved too. I think that they're, and you know, you'll have a view of that. I think that one of the things I'd like to have us avoid, and you said this, so I'm really agreeing with you, is I don't think we want to put people on the defensive. So I don't think the report should be at all critical.
Right.
But I think it has to be also engaging, that we have to somehow get the real human beings who have a stake in this because it affects their everyday work life. Not viewing this as just some consultant said this, so why you don't really have to pay attention to it. So, I mean, I'm aiming toward... This is actually quite similar to your... So your idea that there be this coordinating council, for example, is totally appealing to me, except I don't think you can just do it by fiat and say, we have a coordinating council, because you have to have the people willing to come together and be involved in it and engage in it.
Can that be, if we tender recommendations for the consultant, I mean, I like sitting down, like I said, I'd like to sit down with, you know, people from probation and, you know, literally get everybody on board. But the another alternative is we have these ideas. Let's not call them a preliminary report. They're ideas, right? And that the consultant, then there's some big thing on a, I don't know if it's Saturday, I don't know how they're going to get everybody together, where we tender our ideas and we get feedback. And there it is this, but it is this still collaborative thing where there's prosecution, judges, et cetera. I don't know if that's a good idea or bad idea, because I have to tell you, then there's a risk that you can, because this is very political right now, you get a lot of people beforehand saying, let's do this, and kind of discouraging the tendering of recommendations that we consider.
Well, I was raising it as a question of what's the right process. I think there has to be some process.
What's your sense of this?
Well, I think we should probably continue this process next week, narrow it down. I'm not even completely sure when the consultant is going to be on the ground, but certainly have this ready to go to dialogue with him, and of course his boss is the county board, figure out what we want preliminarily to give to the county board before the end of the term. And as I'm hearing from a lot of people, some of these will need to be fleshed out, have some numbers and statistics. Some of them are ideas that won't. I don't think that we can say right now that we necessarily have a lot of buy-in from the justice system on any of this. And so we can, I don't know what the conflict was with the judiciary the last time they were invited and didn't make it. We can certainly invite, especially Judge Ford, but Judge Klaus, Roger Holland, Judge DeFontis, to come in and maybe throw in their views on this. It's slightly different. The state's attorney has been fairly willing to work with us. She might be willing to do a brain download and talk about some of her challenges in the system, and maybe more than just us picking her brain, she might be willing to come in and talk about some of these things. We've had the public defender, but once again, he, and of course he works for the presiding judge, but we haven't really gotten too much input from him. He was willing to answer questions. Scott?
If I could suggest, and this is one, and I talked to the public defender after he came in, and the one thing, it wasn't something that was said, but I kind of gathered from the way I think he feels, I think any public defender would feel, because the exact point you're making, reluctant to criticize the system because they're working for the chief judge. In a lot of ways, they're appointed. So it might be better, and I didn't realize it then when we asked Grandy, but it might be better to have someone come in who's independent of that, someone who does a high volume criminal defense, who actually. The problem with doing that, though, as I'm working through this, is if you can afford a private attorney, I did private defense work, and I talk with our public defenders in our courtroom all the time, and the problem, I can't really relate to them, because they'll say, well, you know, it's hard because I can't even, my client's gone, I can't reach the phone number. If you could have hired me, if you could hire a private attorney, you don't have the same problems that the masses typically have. So the problem with bringing in a private counsel, you do have independence, but then they don't have the same problems that 80% of the people in the jail will have. But I do see that as a problem. As I think a lot of the public defenders coming in would feel like, well, we're reluctant to criticize because we're appointed, not elected.
Yeah. We've been working with him with the Justice Committee for years. I really don't feel like he feels that he's really an independent policymaker.
Sure.
He is Judge DeFontis' public defender. And so he's not, like, talking about policy. Roger can kind of speak for the judge will have Roger speak for him. The judge has been very active with the jury commission, the commission on jury selection. it's quite possible he himself would be interested in coming in, and we obviously love it if Judge Ford would. I don't know if a week is enough notice, but I can talk with Mrs. Busey tomorrow about trying again to find a time to have him come in.
Only because if we're talking about having these kind of people come in, I would wonder, are we still planning on having another meeting in October? October 1st is planned. Do we have something?
Keep scheduling meetings, absolutely.
Next week is our next meeting, right?
I understand.
We have an October 1st.
What I would wonder is, I almost think it's kind of, I just don't think it's gonna if we say to the judge, can you all come in a week? It's
yeah.
not gonna happen.
Yeah.
But if we were to say to them, can you come the 20th, whatever our next plan meeting is, we use the first to kind of continue fleshing our ideas and figuring out the structure now of these brainstorming sessions. I like that idea, and then maybe then we'll have some actual. Well, I guess have our thoughts organized a little more for when the judge.
I actually think before, even though I was suggesting we talk to them and get them involved if possible, I think before that we want to figure out, well, what is it we want
to
talk to them about?
Yeah.
Right. I don't think it's just.
We need to sort of combine and categorize these.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think it's going to lend itself to that. So, and certainly any of these that the group wants to put in, first of all, if there's a majority, I don't think there's necessarily any reason to not include something. These are generally suggestions, and so even if no one's the least bit interested, it doesn't hurt to put it on paper. And even if something doesn't get a majority, maybe it's not the group report, we can certainly have minority report appendixes if somebody has something that they're dead set on getting in that people don't want. It's words on paper. It's not going to hurt anybody to read it. And so we can work with that. But, yeah, these I think we could probably narrow down. I don't remember any that were duplicative, but we have a process that we can keep working on until we can try to get more people in.
I'm not able to come on Monday, October 1st, but if the process is to categorize these on that day, then when are you thinking that the report or preliminary report would be, or draft report,
list
or ideas?
List of ideas
would go to the county. When you said before the end of our term, what date? What date is it that we're shooting for that?
As of now, this ends the end of October, and the county board's term is the end of November.
So we would have to have our reports by the end of October to the county. And when would it be introduced to them, or how would it be introduced to them?
It would probably be on the justice agenda, probably the November meeting.
The November meeting, okay.
Preliminary would be the most likely way it would work. Now, there's been no opposition to extending this so it can keep going, but for this term, if you want to do it this term, November will be the last justice meeting. The second Tuesday of November will be the last justice meeting of this county board term.
Well, is it advisable for us to have a report at that time, or is it just as well for us to, or what do you think is advisable for us to do, I guess is my question.
Or would it be a list of ideas for the consultant, or is it a list of ideas for the county? Or in some ways, he can think about it.
You might want to do one of each. Anything that we give to the consultant can be less formal. We might want to make sure that we do something with this in November and have a preliminary report so the county board has something to think about when they're going forward, while they're doing the needs assessment. And then after the needs assessment, when they're thinking about what they need to do, by then we will give them more of a report. But something like this ought to help guide people's thinking as they're working with the needs assessment and thinking on that, if we do something in the beginning of November. Correct. The plan is to have the extension vote and possibly add a couple more people at the next justice meeting. But I haven't heard it. I haven't heard any complaints, so I don't think that's a problem. Because previously, it had said October. Of course, we have the full month. October 1st is the scheduled meeting, but that certainly doesn't need to be the last one. So maybe, so it sounds like everybody wants to maybe work more on this list in a week. And October 15th, try to see if we can get some more stakeholders in to talk. Does that sound good?
You know,
that would be another Monday, but if there is a Monday that doesn't work, I don't guess it really matters if it's the 15th or 22nd.
Well, maybe we could offer them a choice of the 15th or the 22nd, if we're inviting.
Yeah, we can do that. We,
if that works for everybody.
Yeah, we can work with them, come back next week and declare.
I'll say I prefer the 22nd, but
you prefer the 22nd?
I would. I've got something else.
Okay.
You know, I just want to have one little comment about this. I think that whatever it's called, the general idea of a coordinating council is really a crucial thing to having some structural way to begin to view this as a system and to take it all into account. And I would love it if we could think toward meeting with the judiciary and presenting to them that idea to get, I think it would be sensible to try to hear what the judges would say about such a council, about participating in it. Because, you know, if we could just get even a general agreement that, yeah, that's worth exploring. I mean, there would be some sort of commitment to moving in this direction. And that's really what I have in mind.
Yeah, and I have to tell you that what I've done before, but I got money from NIC, was to take some stakeholders to a place where they could see this, and they meet with judges who say, this is fabulous.
That might be a next step if we would get it as much as just to get, at this point, just get some interest.
Yeah. Would be. There are ways to do it. Is there any way that somebody can
are we going to get this?
Up and then
I assume we're going to get
somebody
this.
Somebody would need my contact. I can't type. I'm probably the one who should type it up.
Does
but
anybody
I don't
have
time.
Access to a drum scanner? That'd be the way to do it.
If somebody can type this up, that would
you
be helpful.
You could just scan those in a drum scanner.
And I just can't this week.
Can I make a suggestion since you are thinking of this from a system perspective? If you could do some diagrams to show how all these words would work in a system. Doesn't mean you eliminate the words, but a couple of visuals would be terrific.
How about this? I will use my phone, take pictures of these, and type it up.
Great.
Do we have any other next steps or anything else we need to discuss tonight?
I mean, you can take pictures. I can take them to my secretary. I just can't guarantee because she's out of the office.
Yeah.
I can see if she can type them out when I'm in St. Louis. But I just can't guarantee that she can because I don't know. She works for a lot of other people, too. So I just didn't know if Deb's office could or no. I don't think. But if you want to.
I don't know.
To,
I'd have to ask.
Okay.
We can certainly try, but I don't think it'll be a big deal.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you take the pictures, and then because I know I can't type them up, but I can take them down to St. Louis, which is going to be kind of interesting. and then I can at least proof it. But the problem is, then they won't. Guys, they aren't going to get out until probably Friday.
So
it sounds crazy, but I just run in St. Louis.
What we've done today is reviewed everybody's narratives that they've prepared. So aren't they in some sense already here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're I mean, from these reports. And
I mean, you know, we're looking at how do we put together a report. And you know, I think about what Julian wrote, and I'm like, that's one heck of an introduction or a foreword.
Yeah.
And then you have what Lynn's prepared and what we've prepared, and I'm not sure why that couldn't be all integrated into one document and then look at what we have here and see, okay, because there were some things I suppose that James mentioned and that we've talked about that may not be specifically reflected in the documents we already have, but use those and incorporate those pieces that we have.
Why don't we do that?
All
right. But you can take pictures. I'll take it. And if I can't get it typed, I'll at least try to highlight.
I still think we want it boiled down.
It would actually be good to have this. It boils it down.
But this report in here is definitely the bones of what we do. This discussion tonight and these reports were really a lot of what we were looking for. So yeah, this is a great foundation. Okay, is there any other business?
Can we revisit the meeting agenda a little bit again? Did you say Monday the 1st and then the 22nd? Is that?
Well, that would be the 29th, depending on.
Monday the 1st, it sounds like right now the agenda would be to continue discussion of ideas for a board, basically work more with this unless people think that's not necessary and we should cancel it. And that can be canceled a few days down the line if people decide that too. And then the 15th or 22nd, whatever day works best, we'll see if we can. We're going to try to get some stakeholders in and continue the discussion about the justice system.
Does anybody have a preference, 15th or 22nd?
Well, I think it's a good idea to see what would work best for if there's one of those the judge board can make or Judge Stefanis would be interested in coming in.
I would prefer the 22nd.
I can't do the 15th, so the 22nd is the only option for me, or the 29th.
Okay, so everybody would prefer the 22nd.
22nd works for me, too.
And how far is Centralia? I have to go here on the 22nd to get back.
It's very far.
Well, then I'm out.
2.5 hours, 3 hours, probably.
Well, I thought so, but I thought, well, then I won't be.
I don't think you're as far as Carbondale.
It is not as far as Carbondale. But it's
and you can be there.
So I'm not going to. At the very least, I won't be back at 6. So
it's probably 2 hours.
And that was for the 22nd, even.
Yeah, I mean, I may be able to leave earlier on the 22nd to get back from there. So I'll just see. But as soon as we have confirmation, then I can try and work with my schedule. The only other thing that I wanted to share with the group is that my board, would have to have me ask me or okay for me to continue on this board if it were to be extended. And so I won't know that until we have some sense of what the county board does too with your work. So, and Benita's going to be in the same boat. So just sharing that because we have about 4 or 5 very large projects that may take our time. And so that might be something when you're considering additional members to keep in mind. And I won't know until I have a board meeting tomorrow and then I have another one, and they have some pretty progressive schedules for some of the tasks this year, so it may require we have to do some things differently. So
I concur with Michael. I do think there's a positive response for an extension.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard any complaints. Pius is completely fine with it, so we threw in October and kind of hamstrung ourselves, and we were expecting the needs assessment to already be going. But it's going to be a while, so.
Okay. We'll know more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're adjourned.
2.5 hours.
Yeah, I should have looked, right?
Yeah.
So the 22nd would be better if I could leave Centralia.
What time do you have to leave Centralia?
Well, right now it looks like it's Council 5. These are all. Maybe I can adjust. I don't go to Centralia. I have to
Nice little thing.
So maybe I should go earlier and enjoy it, have lunch there, and then come back soon.
Yeah, there you go.
Who?
Yeah.
No, she was here. She responded, but this morning I was checking to see what would be.
We got a lot out of it.
These reports.
I discovered that
I don't know if anybody can read it. I said careful with my husband.
I assume you hadn't seen these before.
No, I haven't.
A lot of them are very thorough.
They are very thorough. Yes, they are. I agree totally.
Now, do you want to take pictures, or should I just take them and then, regardless of what they, I mean, we don't, we'll take them and show up. Okay.
Actually, if you could do the pictures and then put them on slides, that's another thing we used to do with the student board. Otherwise, what we used to do is take them back to campus, run them on drum scanners, and then you can put them in the reports.
There you go.
So that's what's so neat, and then people actually see how it's written and not digested.
So we got a lot of how to, like, things.